720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman on the download tonight. Thanks for being with us. Good to be here. I appreciate you sharing part of your time with us tonight. And holy moly, what do my eyes behold? But it is Roger Badish up in the newsroom.
It is.
It has been years since we have been on the air together at the same time. I think it's been like 2 years. At least.
2 years already?
I think it has.
Since I came back from being sick?
Correct.
Oh, come on. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You got a better memory than me, but then again, I'm old. So.
Also, my mind's like a trap, and I'll hold on to things like, no, actually, 7 years ago, you said this to me. I'll say later.
Oops. No court in the world will hold me to it.
I know it.
It's so great to work with you again. You know that. You're one of my special angels.
It's great to work with you again. It's delightful to see you up there. Although, I believe one of the last times I looked up at the screen here in the studio to see what you're doing up in the newsroom, I think you had on like a leprechaun hat or something.
Oh, yeah, like my St. Patrick's attire. Yes.
There were costume changes to working with you on overnights, Badish.
The last 3 days, let's see, three nights ago, I had my Hanukkah dreidel tie on.
Lovely.
And 2 nights ago, I had my winter snowflake tie on. And then last night, I had my green shirt with red tie.
You've got
so I was covering all. Yeah, I was
Did
covering all.
Did you do anything for Festivus?
Poles in the corner.
I feel like I've celebrated Festivus a couple of times on the air by saying, like this month, just leading up to it, saying things like, let's celebrate Festivus a little bit early and get on with the airing of the grievances.
And I think from reading Facebook, as you know, I spend most of my life on Facebook when I'm not here.
You really do.
There are a lot of people with a lot of grievances.
Well, you know, 2016 has been a year.
Yeah.
I mean.
A true roller coaster of a year.
It's really been a lot. And I think personally for a lot of people, too. I mean, I've
been
talking to a lot of people that some people are like, personally, it was fine. It was just out in the world. It seemed so tough.
Mm-hmm.
But then a lot of people I know have just gone, you know, man. This fell apart and this didn't work out and, you know, I know people that lost jobs and marriages fell apart and things like that and people, they lost loved ones and so I think people are just kind of ready to say like, okay, let's just file this one away, go to the new one. I mean, celebrities will die in the year ahead.
True.
Bad things will happen, but it seemed like it was a lot this year.
Yeah, and I think the, I think for Chicago Cubs fans,
well,
that sent us up to a big high. And then I think for a lot of Democrats and some independents, people who did not vote for our president-elect, I think that was a huge down point. So so when I mentioned roller coaster, it's a very psychological, and you've got someone coming in.
I do.
That can address this. But psychologically, I think this year, more so than emotionally, like, oh, I used to like their songs. You know, that's more emotional than psychological. And I think that's what is affecting a lot of people this year.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely agreed with that one. Yeah. I think, too, earlier today, somebody asked me, I was a guest on someone's podcast earlier today, and he asked me what the defining thing about 2016 was. And I answered that it was really kind of the year of revealing, because I think it made us start talking about things that we hadn't talked about in a while, some things that were hard to talk about. It kind of forced a lot of things to the surface. But at the end of that, I said to him, I also think it was, if I had to pick one defining thing, I think it was the year of the really awkward Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was right after the election, and it was right after the Cubs win. So you had a lot of families really stressed out about getting together, no matter how you voted or didn't vote. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of people that were like, oh, man, this Thanksgiving is going to be tough.
Yeah.
So I did a whole show on my regular Saturday night show. I did an entire show devoted to how to navigate Thanksgiving with relatives that do not agree with you politically, just to keep the peace.
Yeah, very, very tough. I mean, our family pretty much sees eye to eye on politics, but I have a lot of friends that are on Facebook, a lot that I went to grade school and high school with, some that I taught, they're now adults.
Sure.
Some relatives, that are not in the area. And I didn't get involved in necessarily the discussion because I didn't want to get into...
You didn't want to go there.
I didn't want to go there. And I think I'm okay with that, and I hope they're okay, too. I think they were because we never engaged in it. But a lot of stuff I was reading from a lot of people, I'm reading it, and I tried to understand it. Maybe that's the newsman in me. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Right.
Or the negotiator in me.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to understand it, but there were some things that I just wanted to rip what little hair I had left on my head out and scream very loudly into a pillow.
You know what was interesting? It seemed like a lot of people were stressed out about how to navigate Thanksgiving, but in fact, it sounds like things hit the fan over Christmas celebrations. I saw a lot of a lot of people on Facebook that I'm connected to were posting things like, "Okay, we got through Thanksgiving, but I had to leave. I couldn't stay the whole day at Christmas." Mm. I saw a lot of things like that. Aunt Matilda and I had to get into it because she said this thing, and I couldn't go there, and I couldn't bite my tongue anymore. So I think that's
I think as we're getting close to the inauguration, I think it's picking up again. I think it kind of ebbed for a little bit after the election. I think it's starting to pick up again.
Well, I think, too, the Electoral College meeting convening, happened.
Yeah, that's
true. So I think there was a lot of people that were like, let's just hold on until we know what the Electoral College is. I am not surprised. I didn't think anything would change whatsoever.
Well, I mean, Matt Bubala and I had discussions about this over a month ago, and we both looked it up and read the laws, which are for the most part the same for most states, but there are many states that have different rules and regulations for their electoral college. Mm-hmm. It's all a state by state, not a federal thing.
Right.
And after reading all that, I'm thinking, why is everyone getting all bent out of shape about the Electoral College? Nothing's going to change.
Well, that's the thing, because we have greater access to information than ever and just at our fingertips, but yet we're somehow more reluctant than ever to go find it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And a lot of discussions have gone on over the past year without a lot of fact behind it.
Absolutely. There's it boggles my mind how someone will look at a headline. I mean, this has happened to me on things I've written. Someone will look at a headline and say, send me a tweet or a letter or a whatever, a Facebook note or something, and say, you wrote that thing, and I can't believe you didn't address the following. And I was like, it's in the third paragraph. What are you talking about? Like,
well,
did you even read it?
We read the headline. We read the first sentence and get angry or get sad or whatever,
Here's the thing. Sit down and read stuff with a piece of paper and a pen and write all of those notes and then compose your thoughts, because it's just going to make you look bad if you comment on it before you've read the whole thing.
Right.
Because so many comments that I see day in and day out, I can, I don't want to say take down, that sounds too aggressive, but you can easily answer them with, did you actually read this?
Right.
Because it says that.
And a lot of stuff is the elections, I think, were a big chunk emotional, too.
It was not a
factual thing, not like, well, I believe in this point, this point, and this point, like a platform of the party.
No.
A lot of it was very emotional without even getting into the platforms.
For sure.
So
you know what? We got to take a little break. When we come back, I want to tell you a story, Roger, about something that happened today that made me walk a block right here on Michigan Avenue and then come back and speak to a complete stranger to set the record straight about something. Because I overheard a snippet of dialogue that I just could not live with, that I couldn't walk away from. So it's not political, but I'm interested to hear your take on it. So,
okay. All right.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, I will tell you the story of the thing I did today to horrify a bunch of strangers. Back in a moment on 720 WGN. It's 720 WGN. That's Kissing a Fool, sung by George Michael, that we sadly lost this week. What a shock on that one. Lots of celebrity celebrities that have left us this year. We're going to be talking about that a little bit later in the show with our friend Rex Hupke. That's in the 10 o'clock hour. We're going to be talking about that. Maybe we're going to burn some sage on behalf of all the celebrities and all the stuff. Somebody go protect Betty White and wrap her in bubble wrap and all those things, right? Anyway, Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman tonight on The Download and with you till 11 o'clock. So as promised, esteemed producer Tom Hush and esteemed news anchor Roger Badish, here is something that happened to me earlier today. I did the business lunch. I am both Bertrand and Kaufman today. And in between shows, I just hung out here at the tower and was hanging out and doing some work and doing some stuff. And I went out to get a little bit of lunch. And I walked out of Tribune Tower and one of those walking tours was going by. And I love those. I get so excited when I see, I love seeing tourists with maps looking around. I will almost always stop and say, what can I help you find? And they're usually looking for something misguided. And I'm like, nope, that's not where you want to eat pizza. Here's where you want to go. And I send them, you know, I give them advice on stuff to do. But I saw one of these walking tours and this very friendly and lovely and funny woman was giving the tour and she ran up to the side of Tribune Tower, this beautiful building, and she put her hand on the side of it and she said, and she had this group of people with her, and she said, this, ladies and gentlemen, is Tribune Tower. It used to matter so much in Chicago and now it doesn't hardly at all. Now it's basically empty. Nobody is in it. And I was like blown past her when I heard that. And it gutted me. I mean, it really knocked the wind out of me because this may sound really cheesy and Pollyanna, but I've been coming in this tower for about seven plus years. And still to this day, every day that I walk in it, it's exciting and it's beautiful. And I think about all the history that has happened in this tower and all of the things and, you know, I look at rooms and know they used to be this and now they're this. And, you know, where the printing presses used to be then became technology and then became something else. And I think that's so fascinating. But nonetheless, this woman said this and it really hurt my feelings and kind of hurt my feelings on behalf of everybody that works in this building. And so I got almost a block away and then I turned around and I came back and I found her. And Was
she still here at the building?
She was starting to move on. Okay. They were starting to walk towards the Michigan Avenue Bridge at that point.
Okay.
And I stopped her, and she was walking backwards. And the people on the tour, you know, they realized I was kind of behind her because she was in the middle of speaking, and I didn't want to interrupt her. And I smiled and I said, "Hi, I walked by you a minute ago, and I got almost a block away, and I had to come back and say something." And she goes, "Oh, sure, what?" And I said,
"Oops."
I said, "Look. A minute ago, you put your hand on this building and you said that this building used to matter and it doesn't anymore. And I just want you to know that it does." And she goes, "Oh, well, but it I know, because this has a radio station and like the Tribune, but it's really small now." I said, I know all about it because I've worked in this building for a number of years, but it means a lot." And the group, all their faces kind of fell and they were like, "Whoa, boy."
Yeah.
"Oh, boy." And I wasn't going to be ugly about it. I was like, "I just want you to know that, you know, say what you want. And I guess it's valuable for me to know that maybe you perceive it that way. But a lot of people work really hard in this building and it's still good. And it's a great place. And it still does matter. And maybe only to us, but it does." And one of the people on the tour said, "Thank you for saying that. I asked her the same question."
Oh, really?
And she's like, "Don't people still work there? Don't they matter? Don't think it matters to them?" And so I don't know. I felt kind of funny about the whole thing. I was glad I went back because otherwise it would have eaten me alive all mm-hmm. night. It would have driven me crazy.
I wouldn't have walked away the first time. I would have stopped right there.
It shocked me. Yeah, I would have stopped right in my seat.
Yeah. First of all, I haven't taken a tour in Chicago. Why? Because I was born and raised here.
Sure, you know it.
Yeah.
You could give the tour.
I could. Oh, God. Wow, you just gave me another thought for another part-time
side
job.
Side hustle for you, Badish.
Whew, baby. Okay. So instead of editorializing, which I don't think, and somebody who gives tours can correct me on this, please, I don't think tour leaders are supposed to editorialize. They are supposed to give factual information about the places they go to inform tourists who don't know.
Yes.
So instead of putting their hand on the building and saying that, she could have pointed out all the different pieces of the building that came from around the world.
Right.
Hopefully, because I don't know how long it took you to walk one block and then come back.
Seconds, I'm tall.
Okay, well then she did not walk into the lobby to show them, you said it, a stunner, not just for the architecture, which is awe-inspiring, but for the words on the walls from some of the greatest people and minds in history are etched into the walls of the lobby of the Tribune regarding the freedom of the press and democracy.
Absolutely. And, you know, the thing I walked away thinking about, like if she was going to be, you know, defensive about it, I was prepared to say more. I was prepared to say, you know what? And further, I am not alone when I say it has been well over a decade since I've spent a single holiday with a relative because I believe in the mission of what happens in this building so much. I would rather be here and do this. It is so important to me. At times when people want to be off, I'm happy to be the first to volunteer to be here.
Yeah.
And I don't say that as a martyr. I say that because this matters. And I did say something like, or she said something like, why is it getting smaller? And I said, well, because frankly, people don't want to pay for journalism. That's why it's getting smaller.
Yeah.
That's why. And so I did say that, but I was like prepared to say more. But I was like, you know what? Every time I walk in this building, I think about all of the history that has happened since the late 1850s when the Tribune started, and especially since the late 1920s when this building was built. And I know the moments in history that I've been in the newsroom or that I've been on the air, and the adrenaline that hits you when you're like, okay, we're switching. We're not going to talk about this movie I was going to talk about. We're now talking about this huge news story, and the focus that your mind snaps to and how you go, well, I don't know what time my show is. You know, I don't know what time my shift is over. I'm just here to write out the story. And that way that we're trained to do and how we know that's the most important thing in the world right then. And I just was thinking of how many hundreds of people have been involved in that since this organization, since both WGN and the Tribune started, and how many people have sacrificed. You know, it's not a 9 to 5 kind of job. And again, I'm not saying that like a martyr. Well, I'm just saying like we're in it because we believe in it. We're clearly not in it for the money.
It's actually more than that.
Yes.
I want to get into a long discussion, but there was a very thick book that I read a long time ago. It was given to me by a friend. About the beginnings of the press in America.
Mm-hmm.
It started with the Postal Service and the reasons behind it in order to battle the British government and a whole background on it. And if you had the opportunity to read that and understand the beginnings, the underpinnings of the press in America and how important it became that it became part of the first few lines of our Constitution.
Yeah.
That was that important. And that while technology has changed, the underpinnings of the press, the freedom of the press, and the duties of the press
have not.
Now, you may find a different way of getting it, but because of the new technology, it is now paramount on the public, in my opinion, to weed through what is out there, to find the truth, to get different opinions, which is fine, but to help, I don't want to say help the press do their job, but become part of the press as they became part of the Constitution, as the public became part of the beginnings of the media in this country. Do not shirk your duty as a citizen to make sure you are getting the truth.
Right. Right.
And put the onus on those of us that try every day to do that.
Well, I believe that the more platforms we have sharing information, the more essential it is that the readership and the listenership and the, you know, the consumer of that news has media savvy.
Yeah.
And media literacy.
Right.
I think that's super important.
And I know teachers who, oh my gosh, we're late. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, I know we're just late to get to you, so I'll let you go if you want, but.
Yeah. Well, this is for another time, because I wanted to come to it from an educational standpoint, but.
Right. And I have lots to say about I actually have a favor to ask everybody about the way we about some language we use when we talk about journalism. So it's for everybody's good. But the short version is this: instead of saying the media, which is the popular thing to do right now, what I'm asking people is to instead to say to if you have a grievance, instead of saying the media did this, what I need you to do is to click through, look who wrote it, and find that person and deal with them, even if it's on social media or whatever. The reason is because it is getting dangerous for many people who are doing this work, even in a low stakes way. Like I'm not embedded in a war zone, and it has gotten a bit more dangerous for me to just sit here sometimes, just based on reader and listener feedback.
Yeah.
Since the election, like since about a month before the election. And I think it's getting very dangerous the way we're talking about, like, quote unquote, the media. We needed to say this particular person wrote something that I don't think is quite as unbiased as it should be. Like, hold that person accountable, but don't hold that whole news organization. Because frankly, the business desk and the sports desk, they don't talk to each other in any newsroom in the world. So that's not fair. Go to that person individually and take it up with them. That's the short version. I could go on that for an hour. Nonetheless, we've super got to go to break and get to you, Roger Badish, for news here in just a minute on 720 WGN. Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman tonight, doing the download. Thanks for being with us. Appreciate you sharing your time with us, for sure. We've got a lot to do on the show tonight. We're going to be a little bit later talking about the way we go about setting New Year's resolutions is actually completely not a good idea. The way our brains are wired, it's not really compatible with the way we're doing this. So we are bringing in a clinical psychotherapist to talk with us about how to set up New Year's resolutions that are going to actually work and that are not going to make us feel badly about ourselves, that we can actually achieve. So we're going to be doing that, and we'll be taking your calls, kind of free therapy hour. And also we're going to be talking with Pat McDonald. He's a film critic at HollywoodChicago.com. We're going to be talking about Hollywood movies a little bit, but also mostly all the films you need to see to set you up come Oscar time. And then we're going to be talking with Rex Hupke about all of the celebrities we've lost this year. And again, we might be saging the studio on everybody's behalf because it seems like it's been a lot of them. But first, before we do all that, I want to have a conversation about reform. We talk about reform a lot on not only this show, but other shows here on this station in different forms. But in this particular area, I'm talking about justice reform. And that is a big topic, especially as the Obama administration is preparing to move along and the incoming Trump administration is coming in. And it seems like the two of them have pretty competing narratives. It doesn't seem like they're quite on the same page, right? Because here's Trump, who's a man who campaigned as this law and order candidate, and he's heading into the White House. And it seems like there's a bit of a crossroads, right? It seems very incompatible with the things that Obama has said, and because his kind of tough on crime stance has kind of paints a picture like it's going to be a different way. He's going to take a very different approach and perhaps undo some of the things the Obama administration has put into place. So it's murky, right? There's a lot of kind of narratives around it. There's a lot of stuff to sort out. So our next guest is Chandra Bazelko, who she writes the award-winning blog Prison Diaries, and she does commentary on the justice reform in general for a ton of outlets. She also wrote a book while she herself was incarcerated for more than 6 years in Connecticut's only women's prison for nonviolent crimes that remain on appeal. Chandra, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Oh, thank you, Amy. It's a Christmas present to be able to talk to you.
Oh, lovely. Thank you so much. Well, so you have recently written a piece that was in U.S. News and World Report that I found really compelling because it's about kind of the idea of what we can expect and what it looks like we might could expect out of the Trump administration when it comes to justice reform. But it takes really interesting turns because it seems that you point out at some point through the piece that it might be that for Trump to make good on the things that he has laid out, he might actually have to continue with some of the things that Obama has started. It seems as if that's what you're kind of trying to get at some point in your piece.
Yeah, exactly. There's nothing conservative, as Trump claims he is, about the current state of mass incarceration in the country. We are feeding, clothing, and housing 2.4 million people throughout the country. It's a de facto welfare system, and someone who wants to get everyone working, taking care of their own responsibilities and children should actually want to dismantle this system.
Which is really fascinating. There's some really interesting data in your piece that right now almost 1 in 31 adults is under some type of correctional control, meaning incarcerated, on parole, or on probation. In contrast, when Ronald Reagan was president, the total correctional control rate was 1 in every 77 adults, which is really interesting. I think that that is counter to sort of the dominant narrative we have about that. I think we probably believe it was a little bit flip-flopped. It was probably, you know, maybe I think some people anyway kind of pushed that it was much better during Reagan and so different now. But in fact, it is what I think a lot of progressive pundits have been saying, that it is in fact much better than the right has accused it of being. And the number that you bring up that is that you just said, 2.4 million incarcerated people, that's about one out of every 100 American adults right now being incarcerated. That's a really fascinating number. And I think to put it in numbers like that, right, I think a lot of times when we talk about justice reform, it quickly goes to an us and them sort of narrative. Would you agree with that?
Yes, definitely. Especially for somebody like me who's actually been on the front lines. I mean, been inside a correctional facility as a resident. My end of the justice reform debate is definitely, I definitely feel defensive, especially if I'm talking to people who are kind of against reform or maybe think that there needs to be more incarceration. So, yeah, there is a huge divide and a huge dichotomy.
Sure, sure. And so you open this piece in U.S. News and World Report talking about the sense of safety that the Obama administration's stance on justice reform gave you. Tell us a bit more about that, if you would.
Well, Obama has been the first president to really tackle justice reform in a very serious way. We've called it progressive, but in reality, if you look at what he's done, it's just the most sensible and actually most fiscally responsible way to look at the problem that we have right now. It's clearly a problem of over-incarceration. As you said, 1 in 100, so 1% of the country is incarcerated. That's probably something that 20 years ago we wouldn't have even thought was possible. We would have thought that was some kind of Orwellian, you know, sci-fi future that we would never even end up reaching. But unfortunately, we have. President Obama has done a lot of things that are both real, that he's let out and granted clemency to a record number of people. In fact, I think he's granted clemency to so many federal prisoners that it's more than all the last, I don't even know how many presidents combined.
Interesting.
So he's given some real reprieve to a number of people. But he's also given a lot of symbolic reprieve, banning the box and refusing to allow federal agencies to ask about criminal backgrounds if they're looking to hire someone, changing what people are called rather than calling us ex-cons or, you know, felons, things like that. He wanted us to be called returning citizens or formerly incarcerated people, so he tried to change the language. He tried to work change on a number of different fronts. So for somebody like me, even if I wasn't directly affected and, say, wasn't eligible for federal clemency, to know that someone was working on that is very comforting to me.
I'm sure. I think that's a really interesting point that you bring up about language, because a lot of times that gets criticized in the form of someone saying that is just politically correct nonsense. I'll call something or somebody or a system or a thing whatever I want. I think a lot of people lean on that. And I think this really points to the importance of language when you are creating change. I think it's something we overlook a lot at how like the difference in saying illegal versus undocumented versus, you know, as you said, the example you said, like, you know, ex-con versus returning citizen. That is a shift. That is a very different method of addressing people. I've long said that if you catch yourself or if someone's saying to you something is politically correct, switch that out in your head for treating people with respect and just see how it sounds then. And you might catch yourself being kind of hateful, or you might, you know, find the truth of what someone's trying to say. Right. But I think that's really fascinating. Do you see other moments where semantics matter so deeply with change as it relates to justice reform?
Well, I mean, for me personally, because I was called an inmate and a prisoner for 6 years, mm-hmm. it actually doesn't bother me. But when I examine my feelings about that versus, say, something that Obama's trying to do by changing the language, I have to stop and check myself and wonder why it doesn't bother me. So for at the very least, it causes me, gives me some pause about sure. Proceeding with old language and its usefulness going forward. So for me personally, like that, I actually still unfortunately revert to those terms. But I also know in my heart, because I've been there, that I'm not any of these people as anything less or other than people. Sure. But unfortunately, I've come to, you know, as I've worked through my own feelings and stance on this issue, I've understood that the reason why a lot of other people use terms like ex-con, felon, things like that, is that they don't see anyone who's just as involved as a person. And that's one of our biggest problems, I think, facing justice reform. I think a lot of talk about policies and, you know, reentry and banning the box is all wasted conversation if we can't actually recognize that people who we think have done terrible things and may have in fact done them are still people, always have been, and never gave up those human rights that we all value so much.
Certainly.
And
certainly.
Sometimes take for granted.
Yeah. We're talking with Chandra Bazelko. She is she writes an award-winning blog called Prison Diaries, and she does a lot of commentary on justice reform for a number of outlets. Chandra, we're going to take a little break, but I want to keep having this conversation because I still have, I think there's other things I'm dying to ask you about with this issue of justice reform. So if you can stick with us for a second, we're going to take a little break. We will be right back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman tonight here on The Download. Thanks for being with us. We have been talking with Chandra Bazelko, who writes an award-winning blog called Prison Diaries, and she does a ton of commentary on justice reform in a variety of outlets. Google her. You will find lots of things she has written. She also wrote a book while incarcerated for more than 6 years in Connecticut's only women's prison for nonviolent crimes that remain on appeal. And so she is with us by phone today. And, you know, we were talking about this piece that you have recently written in U.S. News and World Report, Chandra, and there's a couple of points in there that I think are so fascinating. And one of them is that while a lot of people sort of justify this, you know, the cost of incarceration, calling it kind of like the price tag of safety, as you point out in your piece, a lot of studies that you mention in your piece have really shown that decarceration and a reduction of crime are, in fact, not mutually exclusive. If you would break that down for us a bit.
Well, I think that what all these studies that are showing that if you reduce a prison population or a jail population, that doesn't mean that you're letting people out onto the street to wild and go crazy revert to bad behavior. It's really getting at the criminogenic effects of incarceration. I think I cited a study that was released this summer from the Washington University in St. Louis, where they actually studied the total cost of incarceration, not just what we pay to keep people incarcerated, but also the effects of incarceration, lost wages, things like that, the crime that is caused by the institutionalization of people. And it rose to about $1 trillion a year. That's what 1 year of our current incarceration system costs us when you factor in absolutely everything. So I think that when we're talking about incarceration and reducing crime at the same time, we have to acknowledge the fact that incarceration, that caging people like animals, can destroy self-esteem that's probably pretty low to begin with in such a way that there's really no downside to breaking the law when someone leaves custody. And that's something that I don't think I ever could have understood unless I had gone through it myself like I did, you know, seeing exactly how low your self-perception and self-concept can get when you're incarcerated and how really you think you have nothing to lose. So there really isn't a problem in doing anything that not only damages your future, but might damage someone else's as well.
Right. And in November, the Justice Department unveiled new prison reforms. And it seems like, at least according to kind of promises made on the campaign trail, it seems like, It seems certainly like Trump really doesn't have any intention of keeping them around, even though, you know, some of them, they weren't necessarily a slam dunk. It seems like some of them did have some issues to them. What are your thoughts on some of those reforms that came through in November in terms of, what is really useful? What maybe he should scrap or is it dangerous to start breaking things out in kind of piecemeal in that way?
Well, actually, I don't think that anything should be really scrapped, even though things might not have been as successful or as wide-ranging in their success as Obama wanted them to be. They were still, like I said before, at least symbolic pushbacks mm-hmm. on certain practices that are really damaging. A good example of, something that Trump has kind of intimated that he's going to repeal is the ban on juveniles in solitary confinement. Mm-hmm. In federal prisons. With that ban, even though it only affected technically 10,000 prisoners, with that ban came a set of rules, like 50 guiding principles of how to treat all people who are subject to solitary confinement, how many times a day you should allow them to walk into free space, get fresh air, things like that. And my concern is that even if you look at Obama's action as the limited action that it was, it only affected a very small group of only federal prisoners and left state prisoners really kind of to fend for themselves. It still was a symbolic statement. It was a message to people that our current practices of segregation in prisons are really damaging and need to be looked at and are worthy of consideration if we really want to stop crime, because so many times people are released from solitary confinement directly to the street. And that's usually when we find the most recidivism, because you're literally released from solitary confinement to like an animal status mm-hmm. onto the streets, institutionalized in such a way that you can't even function. So people a lot of times commit crimes just to go back into an institution where they know their needs will be met. Mm. So there was a couple of things in November. I know that they tried to erect a kind of school within the federal
right.
prison system. While I always support correctional education because it's so great at reducing recidivism, the idea that we would put a school in a prison rather than making sure that students don't have access to quality education before they get in trouble mm-hmm. troubled me a little bit, because we shouldn't have to wait until someone's in trouble and sentenced to a prison term to have to worry or really be concerned with educating that person. It's definitely cart and horse reversed when I read that. So I'm not sure what is going to happen with that. I think it was at least a very good intention behind it, but the effect of it, to try to start educating people only after they've, gone through a fall, mm-hmm. I think it's too late.
Yeah. Yeah.
Incidentally, Jeff Sessions has said he does not believe in correctional education, so it would look like something like that would be on the chopping block pretty quickly.
It's really interesting. This whole issue is very complex, and it is really, really very compelling. And I really appreciate you sharing your very unique perspective with us. We will continue to follow you on social media and look to you for commentary on so many different platforms. You write everywhere, I feel like. But everybody, go follow her on Twitter, and definitely take a look at Prison Diaries. It's prison-diaries.com, correct?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so everybody head over there. You can see all of her recent work and follow her on social media and all that. Chandra Bezelko, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Amy.
All right, we're going to take a little break and get you to news with our friend Roger Badish. And then we come back. It is therapy hour, friends. We have a psychotherapist here, and we're going to talk about those New Year's resolutions, because you know what? We're doing it way wrong. We're setting ourselves up to fail. So we're going to talk about that in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. That is a lovely Smiths cover done by Mex Rissi. It is a fine band. And if you're a Morrissey fan, you get what I just said and you know why it's funny. My friends, it's Amy Guth. Hello. In for Justin Kaufman today on the download. Happy to be with you and grateful to you for spending time with me. I appreciate you sharing your evening. We go now to, we're going to call the next hour therapy hour, because let's be real, we can all benefit from a little bit of therapy. And it has been a year. Has it not? In fact, I saw on Etsy, there was a person selling little Christmas ornaments that was, it was a dumpster fire of an ornament with the with 2016 on it. I don't think it was a total dumpster fire, but you know what? There's been a lot of stress this year, so we're going to have therapy hour. In particular, as we are coming to the end of the year, we're starting to think about New Year's resolutions, and even people who say, I don't set resolutions, I don't believe in them. Even then, you know you're thinking of something. It's a demarcation of time. So something about our brains lets us know it's time to change something, do something different. So even though, even if you're not really doing a resolution, you're doing something, you're thinking something. And so what that amounts to almost across the board is that we make these big plans and then by February we feel like a bum because we didn't do it or we didn't do it right or we didn't live up to it or something like that. So joining us now in studio is Nicole Knepper. She's a clinical psychotherapist and gerontologist and author. Her expertise is in mental health and aging and age-related issues, and she is here with us and we are darn happy about it. Welcome to the program.
I'm darn happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. So this is therapy hour. So let us start with New Year's resolutions because I think a lot of people are thinking about that or some variation of it. But the truth is, it's going to mess a lot of people up.
It does. It always messes a lot of people up because I think that New Year's resolutions put us in that cognitive distortion of the shoulds. The shoulds and the musts, which
yes.
I think, to me, when a new client walks in and they have a diagnosis of the shoulds, that's scarier to me than bipolar, anxiety, depression, anything.
Interesting. You know, funny sidebar. Yesterday I was with a friend of mine and it was raining and she had like a plastic poncho on and she stopped and she was thinking of kind of what we were kind of milling around, just playing around, doing stuff out and about in the rain, you know, and working our way, you know, through the city. And she goes, you know, I should. And suddenly the wind came up and blew the poncho right in her face. And I said, that's the universe telling you
exactly.
Not to say should.
No, there's good shoulds. There's definitely good shoulds. And I love the good shoulds, but most of the shoulds are, they're the world shoulds. They're that external, like the world can be in control of you as opposed to what are your values.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. I think the world shoulds are the things that drive us crazy. Like by this age, I should be doing this, or I should have said that I should, you know, there's a lot of things we think people expect of us that in fact, they don't care. They're busy
Absolutely.
With themselves.
And I'm glad I'm on the radio because I'm doing this. Did you see me eye rolling? I'm eye rolling. I'm, you know, because it's so hard to hear those things. And especially in my job as a clinical psychotherapist, I'm non-judgmental. And truly, I am not judging what people say, but I do get frustrated.
Sure.
Especially when people have this wicked, wicked case of the shoulds. And they're just pummeling themselves. They're destroying themselves with this kind of thing. And, you know, it's a cognitive behavioral therapy thing, cognitive distortions, and they will wreck you. They will just wreck you.
Sure. So when we plan for the year, what is it we should do instead, since we're really clearly going about it the wrong way, since it probably, I don't know, I would love to see some kind of data on how many New Year's resolutions fail, but I think probably, a lot of people probably don't want to admit it.
Right. Well, the ones people say out loud,
yeah.
Right? How many of those fail? You know, those are actually probably less likely to fail because of the accountability. When you say something out loud and people hear you, then they're going to expect you to do it.
Sure.
So that's why things like quitting smoking. You can say it in your head and you can be real quiet, but if you say it out loud and you say to someone, I'm going to do this. And I need to do this and I want to do this. And can you help me and support me on this?
I was going to say, is that a good moment to ask for help instead of waiting to when you really need it?
Always. It's always good to ask for help. You know, and I have, I mean, again, therapists are not, you always hear the story, therapists are just as crazy as the people they treat. Well, nobody's crazy. We all have sort of a degree, you know, range of normal.
Everybody's got their stuff.
We all want to be within the curve. You know, that normal curve, even if you're like at the outskirts, just as long as you're in the curve, that's good, right? But I think, yeah, asking for help, this is what it's all about. You know, a lot of people that come in and see me or come see a therapist in general, you hear all the time, I'm trying not to feel. And I always tell the diarrhea story, which is, okay, so you're driving down the road, right? And all of a sudden it hits you. You have to have diarrhea. It's bad, right? But you can't go in the car because
I have no idea what's about to happen.
It's okay. Because you don't want to go, you don't want to poop in your car. Because do you really want to do that? Do you really want to do that? No, nobody wants to poop in the car except somebody who's really trying to get out of a traffic ticket, which You sure. might do that.
Which is fair.
Right. And people have. I know people who have, but I digress. So you have to hold it and you are sweating, right? You're sweating bullets. And maybe someone else is in the car and they're like, ooh, you're going to poop your pants. And so you get really mad because you're like, ah. So you start screaming like, shut up. And it's terrible. Sure. No, you're not pooping. But this human bodily function is like, hey, me, me, me. And so you're sweating, right? But you hold it. But when you get home, are you kidding? You don't sit in the car in the garage and go, I'm just going to hold this because I'm trying not to diarrhea. I'm going to hold it. No, nobody does that, right? So let's say you're sitting at home, right? And you're watching, I don't know, episode 56 of Grey's Anatomy on Netflix. Sure. And you feel the diarrhea. That's what we call it in my family, mm-hmm. the diarrhea.
Meaning like, adding the. Okay.
It's just coming, right? You don't sit there on the couch and go, I'm just going to hold this and sweat.
No, you're going to go, I'm going to hit pause. I'll be right back.
I know the bathroom's right here. And this isn't the 70s where if we miss it, we miss it. No, I'm just going to hold it. No, we don't do that. We go in the bathroom, right? Now, do we go on the floor? No. Do we go in the bathtub? No, not unless someone else is on the toilet. What we do is we go... in the toilet, right? I know. This has a point. You go in the toilet. Is it messy? Yes. It's diarrhea, people. Oh, right? But it's a human bodily function. And that's what feelings are, too.
Well.
They're the most human thing ever. So when you walk around saying, well, I'm trying not to feel. Okay. You already felt. Right?
Yeah.
Holding it in, it's going to come out. Think about it. You're going to sweat. You're going to be angry. I mean, holding it in eventually is going to come out. And it's probably not going to be pretty.
Fair
enough. It's probably
going
to be pretty messy.
Sure.
It's going to need containment.
I've never compared those two bodily functions per se. But you know what? Now that you have, I see exactly what you're saying.
But they're not that different. And I think that's the thing. You know, when people come in, I always say, you're very brave to come in. It's very hard to come in.
Mm.
Right? But therapy is a safe space. And I think especially, you know, this is a time of year. People are going to come in, New Year's resolutions, reevaluating how you've been the past year, what you want to do in the year to come, making changes. This is a time of year and people need support.
Do you see an uptick? Do you see more people reaching out for therapy at
we
the beginning
do.
Of the year?
We do. You know, it's hard because the deductibles are coming.
Uh-huh.
And everyone's weighing and measuring. How bad does it have to be for me to start in on that deductible?
Mm-hmm.
Because some people have to be on fire to know they're hot. But, you know, they end up coming in.
And I imagine on the tail of the holidays, which is emotional for people, mm-hmm. a lot of people really struggle in the holidays.
Oh, yeah.
And then you kind of get this like, well, it's New Year. Maybe I'll do something different. But
right.
I think you're right. I think we all kind of stew until like, how bad do things have to be before I even complain to a friend or ask for help or something bigger? You know?
Right. Because complaining is somehow weakness. But again, complaining can really help ward off some of the worst problems down the road.
Okay. Now that we have...
talked about diarrhea.
I was going to say, explained feelings and why we should feel the feels in a way that I did not realize we were going to be explaining, which I find delightful and
you're
funny
welcome.
And bizarre. Yeah, you're welcome is what we're saying about that. We are going to get into why the way we go about setting New Year's resolutions is really not that helpful. Our lizard brains are going to both be too dumb and be too smart to let us succeed in that way. We're talking with Nicole Nepper. She is a clinical psychotherapist and gerontologist and author. We'll be right back in just a bit to talk about the real right way to set a New Year's resolution where we can actually succeed at it. That's what we're talking about. And we'll be taking your calls 312-981-7200 as we embark on therapy hour here on the download 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman here on The Download. Thanks for being with us this evening and sharing part of your evening with us. We are most grateful to you for that. We are calling this hour the therapy hour because we have with us in studio clinical psychotherapist, gerontologist, and author Nicole Nepper. She is here with us hanging out in studio. And we're talking about how the way we go about setting up our new year, we think about things we're going to do in the new year, and we think about the resolutions and all those things, we're really setting ourselves up to be a little bit bummed out. So we've been talking about that a little bit. So let us talk. We've established that we need to let ourselves feel the feelings. We've established that in the most fascinating way I've ever heard
You're
that
welcome.
Established. But how is it that we... is it that we're just setting our expectations too high when we go to resolutions, or is that oversimplifying? There's more to it than that.
Actually, I don't think it's oversimplifying, but I go with standards. First things first, we all have standards, right? Those don't change. Expectations, we have to adjust. And I think that's the biggest difference, right? My standard for friendship is that, I don't know, people aren't going to post naked pictures of me on the internet. They're not going to talk behind my back. They're going to say things to my face. You know, the same thing they'd say behind my back, they say to my face, right? That's standards. Expectations, well, maybe if a friend of mine has a stroke, they might not play by those rules, right? So you expect things that are realistic. And I think that's where, if you're going into a resolution or just setting goals or wanting to make some changes in your life anytime, not just a new year, you have to pay attention to those two things. So what are the standards that you want to meet, right, which don't change, and those align with your values? And then expectations come next. But first, it's the standards and it's the value. So what do you not want?
So what would be an example of that, if someone's kind of differentiating between an expectation and a standard?
Okay, well, let's go with the most famous and common New Year's resolution, which is what?
Probably getting fit or quitting smoking or something like that.
Absolutely. Usually it's losing weight. So you start with what you don't want. I don't want to be fat. That might be one. Another one, because I don't really care about being a little fat. The number on the scale to me is less important than the number that my doctor tells me, my triglycerides, which, by the way, are 55. You're welcome. I have the triglycerides of a kindergartner, and that makes me proud because that's the number that represents my overall health, right? So again, that would be a standard. The standard that I am using to judge my overall health would be the numbers that really do indicate what my health is.
Okay.
Right? But my value that's behind that is that I want to be healthy. I want to live to be a burden to my children. I want to throw shoes off my front porch. I want to
say, you damn kids, get off my lawn.
Get off my lawn. I want to see that technology changes. I want to keep living. Mm-hmm. And so those are the values that are going to drive my decisions in the new year as far as my health goes.
Okay.
So that's a great place to start. So I think a lot of people, if they're going to start and they do want to make some changes to their bodies and their health, what don't you want?
Which is interesting because I think a lot of times when we read about kind of self-help sort of things, it's always saying, don't write what you don't want. You know, write it as a positive affirmation. Focus on what you do want. So this is kind of counter to, I think, a lot of messages that are out there.
It is. But it's also not saying that don't do that. But the first step oftentimes is that we might know what we want, but as you said, we don't know how to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we don't know how to get there because maybe it's a should. Maybe it's a must. Maybe it's something external that's coming from somewhere we don't even realize it.
Sure.
So that's where examining your values is really, really important. What are the things I tell clients all the time? What drives the way you spend your time, your treasure, and your talent? And
that tells you a lot. Your treasure and your talent.
Yep.
How are you differentiating between treasure and talent?
Treasure and talent? Well, money.
Uh-huh.
Money, money, money.
Because that talent, treasure. Doubloons. Okay.
Right. Doubloons. Yes. But again, the reason I use it that way is because some people have a lot of treasure to play with and some people have more time and some people have more talent. So whatever you're going to use, you know, use it smart.
That's very wise advice. We're talking about New Year's resolutions in particular of how to, and not just this time of year, but anytime you want to make a change, how to really break it down in a way to help yourself succeed. Because I think change is difficult. I don't think people are really wired for change. I have kind of made myself learn to love it, but I think that's the nature of the career I chose. I've had to be that way to say, like, change is fun because it's coming every 10
it's
minutes.
Coming, yeah.
That's a thing. When I think it's going to be a slow day, it's going to be a crazy news day or something like that. Right. But anytime we're making a change is difficult. And I think anytime there's probably another person involved in it, when we're trying to make like interpersonal stuff, that's where it gets so tricky because we can only control ourselves.
Exactly.
We can put affirmations all over the house, but we can't force it. We can sage people and sage ourselves and throw around Florida water and all those things, but we really can't influence anyone but ourselves, and we shouldn't. We're only responsible for what we're doing here. So as we're thinking through these resolutions, sometimes initially I said, oh, well, but usually people tell you not to focus on what you want. But that's a great point, though, that sometimes if you say, here's what I don't want, or even figuring that out can help you get to where you want to be, because sometimes we don't know. What is it I don't want? Because we're sometimes so stuck in those shoulds. We have a caller, though, so let's do that. Let's say hello to Sue. Hi, Sue. You're on WGN.
Hi. Thank you, and good evening, and thank you, doctor. This is, like I said to the screener, this is right up my alley. I've had different therapies in my life. I've lived my whole life with shoulds. And currently, right now, this has also happened with friends and family in the past, but I'm trying to keep this general, so bear with me. Thank you. On Christmas Eve of all nights, I was talking to my boyfriend, and there's a lot of very challenging issues for a long time in my life with friends and family. And that the analogy that you started out with, yes, that's very apropos. I said a whole lot of things on the phone because I tend to internalize, and then things explode.
Gotcha.
And it's hard. Thank you. It's hard to ask the question. I have tried texting him, and in this case, it's him. I tried texting this person, tried texting him and calling and say, you know, let's just talk. And I guess, how do you, if the person is not responding to you, how best to deal with that?
Okay. So first of all, I want to clarify, I'm very therapist-y here, and yeah, I'm using that as an adjective, therapist-y?
It is now.
Yes, it is. And I'm therapisting with you, which, here we go. Okay, so I think what you're asking me is that you want to connect with your boyfriend, you want to be able to connect and apologize for the things that you said.
Yes, okay. And because it's really not like me, and, well, that's what happened.
Sure. Well, and you know, you're not alone. And it happens to a lot of people. And I think what you said too is that you hold things in. So you internalize and you internalize.
Yes.
Right? But that's not necessarily a character flaw. Earlier, Amy was talking about interpersonal relationships. And I think that we create these habits based on these dynamics, right? Earlier we were talking too, the difference between, you know, being a whiner and a complainer, but also being a healthy complainer. To be able to say, and I'll give you an example, Sue, and it's so general too, but again, you're going through a lot of stuff, but
thank you.
I'm hoping that you can apply this in sort of a general way. Okay. So say you're in the kitchen and you're cooking up and your husband and his buddies are watching football and they're drinking beers, and your husband comes into the kitchen and he plays garbage Jenga. He puts a beer can right on top of the
garbage Jenga.
Right on top of there. And then he says, hi, hon. And he gets another beer and he walks out, and you're thinking, you know what you're thinking. All those
yes,
thoughts.
I do.
Right. And they could be many, many different thoughts, right? So then you just sit there and you stew and you stew and you stew and you stew, right? And then you think,
yes.
Well, I'm gonna march right in there and I'm gonna tell him he's a XYZ, right? But then you talk yourself out of it because he has friends over, and you think about all the wonderful things he does for you,
mm-hmm.
right? But the thing is, those things don't matter. What matters is that you feel upset and you would like him to change his behavior. So you call him into the kitchen and say, I feel frustrated when you play garbage Jenga. It makes me feel like you are, I don't know, assuming that I'm going to take it out, or that you are not being careful with our things. So I would appreciate if you would, from now on, when you see the garbage is full, take it out. He can say yes or no, right? He can mm-hmm. take that as an attack on character, which it's not. So there's a simplicity to it. I feel when you.
Right.
So the first thing for you is just being able to express your feelings in a context that you own them, right? And then you relate them to
right.
your behavior. And then I guess we might even have to get back to this, but to say to your boyfriend, hey, I feel sad when I don't express myself and blow up at you. And I would like another chance to do this better. And if he lets you, great. If he doesn't,
yep.
It stinks.
Because he is a great guy, but
and you're a great lady. You're both great. It's just about communicating correctly, right? And having some.
That's it. And thank you very much. And I just want to say, I do really believe, and I try to believe in getting it out sooner than later and being proactive and not reactive.
Absolutely. Better out than in. And Shrek said that.
I like that very much.
Thanks, Sue.
Thank you so much, and Happy New Year. Thank
you. Happy New Year to you.
Thanks, Sue, and good
luck.
Thank
you.
All right, we're going to take a little break right now, and we're going to get you to news and all of that good stuff. Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman on The Download here on 720 WGN. So 720 WGN. Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman on the download tonight with you till 11 o'clock. Thanks for being with us and sharing part of your evening with me. I super appreciate that. We're calling this the Therapy Hour, and we're about halfway through the Therapy Hour. It goes so darn fast. We're here with Nicole Knepper. She's a clinical psychotherapist and gerontologist and author, and her expertise is in mental health and aging-related issues, and she's here talking with us tonight about change. We're talking about it in terms of New Year's resolutions, because I think we can all agree we pretty much roundly screw that up. Right? Most of us do. Pretty much. We've all kind of let ourselves down with a New Year's resolution at one point or another, even with the best of intentions. Even like super goal setters can kind of like botch that sometimes. So we're talking about it in those terms. But you know what? These are things you can apply any old time you want. So we were just talking with a caller that brought up something interesting, and that was about how much we can't control what other people do. And I think we tend to wait a lot for, okay, when this person does this thing, then I can do this. And I think where I hear it the most from people that I know, it's about, I won't be able to say that thing until this person does that.
Right.
When this person comes around, tells me how they feel about me, or does this thing at work, or straightens this out, or when they stop doing this or start doing this, that's when I can say the thing. But before that, I can't.
All the time. And that's where that Sue talked about internalizing her feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And she set up this beautiful, you know, for the next thing, right?
Sure.
So again, boundaries.
Yeah.
Everything comes back to boundaries, right? If you are not making a choice based on what you want, it's not your choice.
Mm.
So if you're not saying, I feel this way because you don't know how someone else is going to respond, you're not really choosing.
You're letting it be all on them.
Right. And if you think of a circle, right, with, you know, you inside of it, just you, you're standing there all cute, wearing whatever you want, and you're at your very best, right? There's four things inside there, right? You have your rights, those human rights. You have your choices. You have your privacy. And you have your identity, right? And, you know, I'm not talking minors or people that are severely mentally mm-hmm. ill or have dementia or other, you know, conditions that their rights are taken away from them, you know, like prisoners who have violated someone else's. But, right, we all have rights. Even the littlest baby will tell you they don't want food because they'll chuck it across the room.
That's true.
They're choosing, right?
Yeah.
But the more you push it at them, sometimes they're just going to make a choice based on just getting you to stop.
Hmm.
Right. So we even do that to the tiniest babies.
Interesting.
Right. And it's sad, I think, in a way. And then if you think about in terms of privacy, we all have the right to privacy. Right. But in a good relationship, there's transparency. Right. So maybe sometimes like, and sorry, Sue, we're using you as an example here. Right. Sue kept those thoughts private because she needed to, because she wasn't ready to communicate them. Right. Maybe she didn't think she had the right to, or maybe she was making that choice based on how someone else would respond. And then if you have that identity in there, maybe that's who Sue is, right? But maybe she's bringing, we'll call him Fred into there, right?
Oh, man, if his name is really Fred.
Oh, let's just
you never know.
Do something.
Right.
We got to put Fred in there, right? She's making choices based on who Fred is, not
sure.
who she is, right?
Right.
And that's a Sharpie line. That's not a dotted line. That's a hard line. And the only time that line is crossed or should be crossed at all is when there's a safety issue. There's truly a safety issue in terms of violating somebody's rights is because they're not safe.
Right, right. I like that. I wrote that down. Human rights, choices, privacy, and identity. Those are the things in the circle with you.
And I think those choices, too, when we talk about making a decision, right? You want to do something. Well, when work slows down, you know, when the baby starts sleeping through the night, when my husband stops working less, you know, there's always a reason. But again, if you want something, you're going to create an environment that allows you to do it.
Yeah, I've long said, you know, I got this advice years ago and it really changed my mind and changed my thinking. Somebody said, you know, it's not that you don't have time. It's that it's not a priority.
Right.
And so stop saying something like, oh, I don't have time, but I will. In fact, just come out and say, that's not a priority to me right now, and watch your life change. And she was absolutely right. And it changed the way I said no to things. It changed the way I shaped my day and the projects I took on. And that was very powerful to me when that was pointed out to me. That's like, no, it's not that. And she was, in fact, it was a project that I had kind of stalled on.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, it's not that you don't have time. It's that you don't give a damn about this project
right.
and you don't want to admit it. And I was like, yeah, fair enough. Yeah,
exactly. But isn't it amazing how in that moment, your brain went,
Oh, it was complete liberation.
Right? Because you're thinking one way, but there's another way to think. And that, I think that too is where that mindfulness comes in. Mm-hmm. Because when you're in that moment, you can think that way. But if you're thinking in the future, you're already at the outcome, then you're not in that process, right?
Yeah.
And what you're talking about is being in that process, like being able to say, what am I thinking now? I don't care.
Yeah.
Right? As opposed to if you're in the outcome thinking, I really should be doing this, I should be doing this, and this is the end goal. You can't leap there.
Yeah. And that's really powerful. And that can get deep very quickly when we're thinking in these terms here that we're talking about with New Year's resolutions, when we're thinking about, because I think sometimes what we're really asking at that point then is if you want to say, you know, the two examples we kept using were to get in shape or quit smoking.
Mm-hmm.
That's those things go much deeper. Then we're really talking about much bigger things.
They do. And, you know, let's take smoking for an example, because this is a hard one. This is so hard. I mean, I'm a former smoker, so I can tell you it was really hard. I grew up in a smoking home. I liked smoking. As a matter of fact, if I get diagnosed with something terminal and it's going to end, I'm firing up. I'm going back. You know, that's how it's going to go because I like it.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that it's not good for me and it's not good for my health. And it's again.
And it's incompatible with that goal that you had of living a very long time and all those things.
Right, like yelling at kids and having cats and stuff like that. So if you think about it, right, one of the hardest things to do is to tolerate frustration, to be in distress and know that you will survive it. You know, your worst moment, think about the worst moment you've had. You're still alive, right? Everyone's still alive. You got through it. It was horrible, and there are varying degrees of horrible, right? Sometimes you think you can't take it anymore. You know, grief can be like that.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, disappointment can be like that, but you'll be okay. But that moment, oh, it's awful. You know, and that's where that frustration comes into, I think, with any type of addiction. You feel bad.
Hmm.
You know, the reward center of your brain is like, wait a second, I don't know how to do this by myself. And you have to sit there and feel bad. And why would anyone feel bad when feeling good is one spark away?
Yeah, yeah. Right? And I think we are in a place kind of culturally where we don't want to be uncomfortable.
No, we don't
want to talk about weird things. I mean, we even make it a joke, right? We go, awkward, if we bring up something that, you know, like if someone says, oh, how's your mom? And you're like, oh, she just died.
Yeah.
Oh, awkward, I made it weird. Well, no, you didn't know. It's okay. You didn't know. Or, you know, I think we joke our way through those things or we, the slightest little headache, we take an Advil. You know, we're done. We can't be uncomfortable for even a minute rather than, well, I sit in a terrible chair that makes me sit in a weird way.
Right.
I'm just going to keep taking Advil. I think we kind of do that with a lot of things in our lives.
A lot. And mindfulness is the buzzword. Everyone's talking mindfulness, right? And I don't know if you've heard people say, well, I can't be mindful. I can't shut my mind down.
Yes.
That's not what mindfulness is. Mindfulness, who shuts their mind down? Dead people.
Right.
That's who shuts their mind down.
By definition, not living.
Dead people. You can't shut your mind completely down, but what you can do is focus it. You keep bringing it back. You know where you are. So you ask yourself, what is true? Right? And in a moment when you are miserable, you say, I'm miserable. I hate every minute of this, and all I want to do is feel better. Right? But then you say, but I will feel better soon. And even identifying how you feel, that sort of releases some of that tension, right? And it makes room for something else. Makes room for an alternative.
Sure, sure. And then that brings us to kind of our internal dialogue, which I think is part of our part of mindfulness, that even I think sometimes the jokes we're making really are very impactful. We're talking with Nicole Knepper. She's a clinical psychotherapist and gerontologist and author. She's in studio with us. We're having therapy hour. We're talking about all the feels right now. Feel free to give us a call, 312-981-7200, if you have a question for her. If we will get to as many of the calls as we can. We only have so much time, but we will certainly try. But we'll be right back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman tonight on The Download with you till 11 o'clock. And then we're going to turn things over to Hannah Stanley, our good friend Hannah. She'll be in talking about all the things. She just stopped by to say hello. If you saw her on the live stream, that was her. So we're hanging out. We're talking with clinical psychotherapist, gerontologist, and author Nicole Knepper. We're having a little bit of therapy hour here. 312-981-7200. If you have a question for her, we will do our best to answer it. But we were talking a little bit before the break about New Year's resolutions and Boy, are they so much more complex than we think they are. We think we're just writing things down that sound fun, but as we're sitting here unpacking all of the things, we realize there are structures and processes and, frankly, a little bit of work we need to do on ourselves on the front end before we start digging into new things we want to add or subtract from our lives, it certainly sounds like. But let us talk. We were talking just a bit about the state of being uncomfortable and how that drives some people so crazy. They can't just sit in whatever they're feeling. They got to do something about it, whether that's with a substance or a behavior or right. acting out or whatever that thing is, or just complaining or ignoring it or pushing it down or whatever that thing is. But in that, I think is very that is all very tied up in the way that we talk to ourselves, and I have to believe. That is very connected to the success of the things we want to either achieve or subtract or whatever as we're making these resolutions or wanting change in our lives. And I think it seems like, at least I see it this way, I see a lot of people making jokes about their self-talk. You know, they'll joke about being, oh, I'm an idiot. Or, you know.
Right. Sometimes it's self-deprecating.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's really just using humor to kind of buffer the sadness. A lot of the most famous comedians will tell you, I'm like this because of pain.
Yeah.
Pain brought me here. You know, Stephen King, one of my favorite authors, says that he was prepared for literary criticism by his babysitter who abused him. So there you have it.
Wow.
You know, so sometimes worse things bring out humor in us.
Interesting.
But then we don't say, I'm in pain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm feeling weak, I'm feeling helpless, and I can't do this. So I'm just going to make a joke and run away with it.
So how do we begin to address self-talk? Because I think a lot of times I don't think we realize we're doing it until someone points it out to us or something like that. And it's, boy, is it no fun to be called out.
It's not, but sometimes it's the greatest thing, especially if the person calling you out is a safe person.
Sure.
And a lot of people who I see, they come in, they say, I've never talked this much in my life. But then they'll say, but I've never had anyone listen this much. And that's the difference, I think, between therapy and friendship. I ask questions. Tell me more.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, full stop. I want to hear more about that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to tell them what to do, but I'm going to keep asking questions, right? Because I want to know what that self-talk is. When it's banging around in your head, it's not coming out. So it's getting jumbled up with everything else. So as it starts coming out your mouth, right, you have to slow it down.
Mm.
It's just like writing. You know, they say writing is great for therapy, too, because you must slow down and get those words out. And I think the more you can slow down that process, then you have the awareness, that mindfulness.
Yeah.
Again, it's not clear your mind, it's focus your mind. What is your mind telling you? Because if your mind's saying, I'm in distress, I am scared, I'm frustrated, I'm really afraid I can't do this, whatever this thing that I want to do is, whether it's be more assertive, quit smoking, find a new job, start blogging again, whoever that person is, like me. Right? You have to say to yourself, what's true?
Mm.
What's going on? And I tell people all the time, two questions. What is true? What should I do? And this is where the good shoulds come in, right? The good shoulds are, right? Is it safe? First thing. Whatever you're going to do, right? Make sure it's safe.
Mm-hmm.
Is it genuine? Is it real? Is it what you want to do? Right? And the third thing is that, is it kind? Because we can't just do the things we want and stomp all over everybody else.
Sure.
Right? So it's like, well, guys, you know, mom is going to work out, so you fend for yourselves. Or, you know, I'm going to quit smoking, so you guys have to just deal with me being a complete jerk.
Mm-hmm.
No. Right? What is true? What should I do? Right? But even knowing what is true is hard for some people. And what do you really want? Do you really want to lose weight? Or does somebody say you really should? Or do you just not want to buy new pants?
I think that's what I mean when I say there's so much front-end work to just...
So much.
It's not about just writing down something on a post-it saying, okay, I'm going to do this and this and this in the new year.
Right, because that's outcome-focused.
Yeah.
And outcomes are great. We, you know, again, you have to begin with the end in sight. Of course we do, right? I mean, Richard Branson's one of my favorites. He's the virgin... All
eccentric
the mega,
billionaire.
Right. And his schoolmaster when he was young said he was either going to be in jail or he was going to be famous. Right.
Well, those are your choices.
Exactly. Because he was so extreme in what he was doing. But the thing is that he was genuine and he was so lucky. You know, he had trouble with learning and dyslexia and focus. But he had parents that said, okay, we know what you don't do well, but we know what you do well. So we're going to fill in the holes for you. We're going to figure out how to prop you up. And, you know, they taught him that good people matter. And I think that's one of the greatest lessons that we can teach our kids, but also that we can start teaching ourselves if we haven't already in life, right? Good people matter. So people that are going to support your goals and mm-hmm. support those outcomes, right? People want you to succeed. Nobody is trying to make you fail, right? Your husband didn't, or your wife didn't work late because they didn't want you to work out. They worked late because they have to work late. And if you were to say, hey, I was frustrated, but I understand what you have to do, but I want to make sure that you know that I need your support to go through this process.
Which is the boundaries that you were talking about. Because sometimes if
Absolutely.
You don't tell people what you need, it's very difficult for them to meet it.
And people will talk themselves out of needing all the time, which kills me.
Yeah.
I have another metaphor. Are you ready for another metaphor?
Will it top the diarrhea metaphor?
Maybe, but
okay,
it's not about poop. Okay, so Amy, if you were on fire, what would you do?
I would stop, drop, and roll.
Right. Everybody knows that. Everybody knows that.
Sure.
Even people who are in the early stages of dementia would stop, drop, and roll when they're on fire, right? Okay, next question. Do you know anyone who's ever been on fire?
No.
No, most people don't. I do. My neighbor, because he was trying to put on a Kiss concert with gas and stuff like that in the garage. So I do. I know one person that was on fire. One person. And I'm going to be 47, right? So we teach kids this when they're tiny, right? Naperville has a whole thing, safety town.
Yeah,
right?
The How little tiny safe, houses, yeah.
Right? Nobody is almost ever on fire. The fireman came to my work the other night because a fire alarm went off. No fire, but they looked great. Right. So why don't we teach kids what to do when they're uncomfortable?
Mm.
Right. Everyone's going to be uncomfortable. Everyone's going to be anxious. Right. There's nobody who's not going to be anxious because that's kind of the human condition.
Sure.
We're alive because we're anxious. Right. There's a stop, drop, and roll for anxiety. And what is that stop,
yes,
drop,
tell
and
us
roll?
What it
right?
is.
It's a situation, thought, feeling. So, again, we implement that. What is true? What is a situation? You know, this is really, you know, old school cognitive behavioral therapy, but it's a kind of stuff where we don't slow down and think about it. So yeah. What is the situation, right? I need time to work out, right? Thoughts. I don't want to ask for help. My husband works hard. I don't know how I'll shuffle everything around because I'm already stretched too thin. I'm afraid. Right? Oops, we just went to feeling. Right?
Could thoughts also be, maybe, could you also call them the yeah, but?
Thoughts are always a yeah, but.
Yeah, the things we tell ourselves, like, I would do this, but I gotta.
But, and that's yeah. where, if you start with the triangle, right, the situation is the bottom left of the triangle, right? And then you go up to thoughts, and the thoughts can go either way. It can be the positive, or then the yeah, but.
Sure.
Right? But then you go down to that right corner, and that's the feeling. And the feelings come from the thoughts. Right. And we don't always realize that. We go straight to feeling, you know, fear, disappointment, frustration, but we don't go back to what the thoughts are. And the thoughts are usually where you can find out, what do you need? What are these things that you need in order to get that process going? Because, for example, we keep using losing weight, and it makes me kind of sad in a way because there are so many other great goals. But
yeah.
Again, I mean, 9 out of 10 people listening are like, it's all about my butt size. So we'll just go there. We got to focus. But again, what do you need? And how do you get what you need? Because most of the time, if you ask somebody for something, they're going to try to help you.
Sure.
How many times have you told somebody no? If they really need something. Not a want, but a need.
Yeah. I mean, if someone genuinely says, "I this has happened, I need this," you're like, sure, yeah.
Right. But we don't make people qualify it either.
No.
Well, you know, I mean, you're not on fire till you have third-degree burns. No, you're on fire when you're on fire.
Let's put you out.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think most people, they're third-degree burns before they know they're on fire.
Mm.
They haven't done the situation, thought, feeling. They will talk themselves out of needing anything. You know, your knee is creaking. I can't work out because my knee has been grinding, right? But most people won't go to the orthopedic doctor or the doctor until they need knee replacement.
And do you believe that we sort of... I don't want to say prize, but we sort of reward not needing.
Oh, yeah. Not feeling.
Yeah. There's some degree of, wow, so-and-so is so self-sufficient and strong.
Right.
And that person never needs anything, never whines, never does anything, never complains. And it's just all okay.
Yeah.
I think those people probably struggle the most.
So much.
And Because when those people have needs, nobody knows what to do because they're so used to that person being
right.
like, I'm cool, I'm
and they
fine.
They don't ask. They don't even think of it. And yeah. if you go into the circle that I talked about earlier, the boundary circle where you have identity,
mm-hmm.
our identities are shaped by our relationships, these interpersonal relationships, right? So if you grow up hearing, she has just been the greatest kid, always my helper, but that one, forget it, you know? And then that one is the one who doesn't care. And
yeah.
That one's the one that goes, it's okay, because that's who I am. I'm the clown. I'm the goofball. I'm the loser. Whereas the one who's the good kid, right?
A lot of pressure to put on a kid.
It's a lot of pressure, and it's not sustainable because everybody needs something. We are human, and not needing something just takes you away from intimacy. And if you can't need something from somebody, then you don't have intimacy. And that, I mean, I can't imagine how lonely that is for somebody to not be able to say, I need,
yeah.
and to be able to know that someone will meet that need and that you don't have to do anything in return.
And meet it gladly.
Yes, because I think, they care for you.
Yeah, I think a lot of people probably, I mean, I feel like I'm just kind of reflecting on people that I know and things people have said to me over the last couple of years and problems people have had. And it seems like there's a lot of, there's a reluctance to believe someone would give gladly.
Absolutely. And think
that people would be mad or begrudging about giving.
Well, right. And think about this. Okay. So as a person who likes to give, and I like to give, right? It makes me feel wonderful.
Sure.
It's such a great feeling when I can say, I'm so glad that I could help you, right? It's part of who I am. It's part of my values. So why would I begrudge someone else that same thing?
Right.
I know how good it feels. So I'm saying, oh, well, they don't want to feel that way. I don't get to decide for them.
Right.
Right. And I know my closest friends, it makes them happy to help.
Mm-hmm. And that's why you picked them.
Absolutely.
I love this. Therapy hour. This is a thing we should do more often. I feel like. Because, right? Everybody can benefit from
everyone
a little bit of therapy.
Everyone can benefit from therapy.
Because I know. I recognize myself in moments in this last hour. I'm sure everybody did. I'm sure we all went, oh, man, that's the thing I do. Right?
Well, and the storytelling helps, though. I think the storytelling is so helpful. And, like, I tell a story, and this is one of my favorites. One day, I was trudging in with groceries, carrying them in, and I see my daughter and my son and my husband. They're just sitting around, and I'm thinking, those, you know what I'm thinking?
Yeah.
They don't care, and they're right. so this. And then I just stopped, and I thought, ask for help. And I said, you guys, can you help me bring groceries in? Boom. They popped up, got their shoes on, and they helped me.
Yeah.
And it was like that Staples commercial. That was easy, and that was it. You know what I mean?
Right.
All I have to do is ask. Now, I mean, it's not always that simple.
Sure.
Right? My daughter will, you know, she could be bringing her dish to the sink and I say, hey, can you bring me a glass of water? And she'd be like, ah, it's like I told her to cut off her arm and eat it.
Sure.
Right? That's how she is. But she'll still give me the water. You know?
Well, there's a lot to it, right? There's a lot of things that go into just making the simple resolution and wanting to change. And I think it's noble to want to change and want to be better and want to be our best selves. But as we have talked about this last hour, there's certainly a lot to it. And there's a lot of things. There's a lot of ways we can all grow. I think we can agree. We're human. We're all in this human mess together. And at the end of the day, none of us are getting out alive. So we might as well try to be our best selves while we're here, lean on each other, and ask for the things that we need. That beep means that I've been talking too long. So, Nicole Neffer, thanks so much for being with us today. And we will have you back for sure because we all need a therapy hour every so often. So we'll do this again soon. But we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to switch topics. We're going to be talking about movies that we need to be watching. Speaking of feeling all the feels, movies that we need to be watching to get ourselves ready for the Oscars and some holiday movies that we can still sneak in this week before we get into the new year. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Amy Guth in for Justin Coffin tonight on The Download. Confession, I love that song. And I know all the words, and I sing along to it all the time. And also, weirdly, it was my prom theme. I'm not even kidding. Hooray for Hollywood was my prom theme.
Where'd you go to the prom in the 50s?
No. But nonetheless, it was my prom theme. And the tickets looked like little movie tickets. It was quite cute. It was really just a ploy to have cheap decorations in the form of popcorn on the table. That was all.
That's funny. Yeah. My junior year, we had a movie theme for our prom.
Oh, what do you know? There you go. We have a new guest with us in studio right now. I'm very excited to tell you all about. That is Pat McDonald. He is a film critic at HollywoodChicago.com, and he is the chief tour guide at Chicago Film Tour. I got to go on that because that sounds super fun. And you just take people around and show them all the film-related stuff.
On the bus, we have video, and we show them the video clip. Then we show them the location. Pretty simple.
That's pretty fun. How long is the tour?
It's approximately 2 hours. We go up. As far north as Uptown and as far south as Chinatown. And we're closed for the season now, but if you want to do a private tour, 312-593-4455, there's the plug.
There you go. Nice. You snuck that right in.
I did.
Nice. Well, we are gathered here this evening to tap upon your lovely and wonderful and considerable cinematic knowledge, because now is a good time to get ahead of the Oscar thing.
That's
because
right.
All the speculation's going. A lot of people think, oh, it's going to be this one, or we're going to do here and this. But now's a good time to make sure we've seen a lot of them.
Exactly. And, you know, the first foray into the award season has already begun. The Golden Globes announced their nominees.
Any surprises for you in that one?
Not really.
Do you think anybody got overlooked? I mean, always somebody.
Yes. I don't have the exact list of nominations in front of me, but I looked it over quickly. I didn't see anything that really shocked me or some glaring omission because, you know, they expand in the picture category in the two categories. They have the comedy musical category and the drama category also for best actress and best actor. So with 10 people in each category, it's hard to say, well, somebody was admitted.
Yeah.
Omitted.
Okay. So we should decide now.
Or admitted.
Are we going to tell, are we going to say no spoilers? Or are we going to say there might be spoilers? So
I'm a no spoiler guy, so I can talk in general about a film without spoiling it.
Okay. I don't care about spoilers because I'm still going to enjoy the movie even if I know the deal, and I honestly will probably forget by then because I have so many things in my head at a given moment. You can tell me exactly how something will end, and I'll, after the movie, go, oh yeah, so and so told me that was going to happen. That's okay.
Well, in Jackie, a president dies. Spoiler alert.
That one we know.
Okay. So.
Do you remember when it was like the anniversary of the Titanic film and it was re-released and a bunch of people on Twitter were tweeting because they did not realize it was based on a true story?
Wow.
Do you remember that?
I do not.
I remember being very disappointed in the educational system that day because it was mostly young people that were going, oh, I didn't realize that was based on a real thing. I was like, come on.
I think history as a subject and a remembrance has been sacrificed in this technology age. I really do.
Why do you think that is?
Well, because I think information has become such a overwhelming sensibility to most people that they, you know, make their own little silo of what they want inside their information base.
Happens.
And I think a lot of it doesn't have anything to do with history, you know, more, you know, their history or modern history or what I put on Snapchat or Twitter or that sort of thing.
Plus, I think if something moves, when we're moving at internet speed, it's hard to remember what happened a week ago.
Exactly.
Much less 150 years ago, certainly. But nonetheless, back to movies because, and we went on the history tangent because Jackie is a movie that a lot of people are talking about. When I first heard Natalie Portman was going to play Jackie Onassis, my brain split in half because one half went, of course that's who should play Jackie Kennedy Onassis. And then the other half of my brain went, but she's that little girl from Beautiful Girls. She can't be in that. She's just a kid, which is not true. She's a grown woman. She's a mother. She's, you know, she's all grown up. But immediately my brain split because I think there's something still kind of, I don't know, a little bit childlike about her, probably because she was a young star. But I think she did it. I mean, I think it's
magnificent performance.
So many people are saying such lovely things about that film.
The she has the same, you know, almost structure as the real Jackie Kennedy, and that really helps the portrayal. You kind of forget it's Natalie Portman at some point because you're so engrossed in the story, which is essentially the 7 days that follows John F. Kennedy's assassination in November of 1963. She gave a very significant interview a week after that occurred. And Billy Crudup plays the journalist who represents a lot of journalists that talked to her and went over the events of the assassination. And it goes into flashback at that point. So,
And so where do you think that's going to land? Do you think that's going to?
Well, that's definitely in my top five. I haven't made my top 10 list yet, but That's definitely in my top five, and it will probably be near the top. I don't know about the buzz right now. I know Portman's getting the buzz, mm-hmm. but for the film itself, I'm not seeing it in a lot of these preliminary speculations. The film itself is different. I think it's different than a history lesson. It's different than a stylized American film because it's directed by Pablo Larraín from mm-hmm. Chile. And he actually has two notable films this year, Neruda, yeah. which is the bio of the famous Chilean poet, and of course, Jackie. So two biopics this year, which is very, very interesting. But his style is so, it's hard to describe. It's like you're there and not there. You're observing and not observing, if you can understand that.
Right.
You're like outside the bubble and inside the bubble at the same time.
Yeah.
I'm a big Kennedy fan. I mean, you know, having grown up in the 60s and 70s, the effect of that administration absolutely defined America for so long, and the effects of that tragedy. So to look at it as Larraín did was to give it a new spin, a new vitality, and a new humanity. So
sure.
I was very, very impressed with that film.
You know, a minute ago you said, you know, the buzz being is mostly around her, not mm-hmm. so much the film, which I
yes.
think is really interesting because I've noticed this is, I think, a byproduct of maybe of social media, but maybe just kind of the cultural moment we're in, maybe because we just went through an election year. But I think we're in a very black and white thinking kind of time, like where if you speak critically of a candidate, even if the candidate you were going to vote for, somehow you've
yes.
betrayed them.
Yes.
Like you have to kind of take it all hook, line, and sinker. And I have noticed that in the film world, not so much those of us who are working in it and doing stuff in the film world, but
right.
the people going to films and talking about them, right? I'm just the average audience member. I'm seeing that same kind of very polarizing way of talking about films that either you love it or you hate it. And then if you really dig, like, well, what did you hate about it? Well, I really just hated this one guy, but he ruined it. He ruined the whole thing. But I'm like, well, but you need to see the difference between like an actor who will stun or disappoint and what that, you know, sometimes there can be a standout in one film and the rest of it can be a dud.
Well, I think the internet is also started a groupthink sort
sure.
of deal in film and popular entertainment, even
yeah.
that, you know, if you're not into this trend or this thing or this moment, then you're not with it.
Yeah. And know? I think the default intellectual setting is snark, which I've said many
there
times in
go.
The program, where you can't just say, you know what, I enjoyed that film, or that book was great. That was delightful, and I enjoyed reading it or watching it or whatever. You have to go, well, this director this, or, you know, you have to kind of be snarky in order to have some kind of intellectual clout, which is disappointing. Because, and I think that has been challenged by one of the Oscar contenders, I believe, it
yes.
should be, and that is La La Land.
Ah, yes. Highly romantic. I watched it again. I saw it at the International Film Festival, and then, you know, 2 months came and went. So I picked it up again and watched it, and I liked it a lot better the second time. I didn't mm-hmm. like it as much the first time.
Really?
I thought it dragged
okay.
a bit in parts, and I didn't think Ryan Gosling was perfectly cast there.
Okay.
But once I got over that notion and watched it again, it was a lot more entrancing to me. I saw what the director was doing. A lot of Damien Chazelle, director, and he did Whiplash, which
yep.
was my favorite movie 2 years ago. And he's inviting us back to that cinematic time in the studio system
yeah.
where musicals were lush and romantic
mm-hmm.
and substantial. And
right.
I think those three words absolutely describe La La Land.
Yeah. Even so far as making that point and underlining it twice by having her work in a coffee shop on the Warner Brothers lot.
Yes.
Right. Like
yes.
I think that was such an interesting touch to make sure we got that point, that
right.
this is a return to that silver screen studio time. I thought it was very enchanting.
Yes.
The thing I said when it was over, I sat there, I could not move. I watched the credits and then I said, lovely and gutting. And I don't necessarily mean gutting in a bad way, because it was
right.
just like all the feelings. It just kind of rips your chest open and makes you feel a lot of things. But I thought it was lovely. And I thought it was refreshing, because it was hard to be critical and mean about that movie, right? It was hard to be.
It is hard. It is hard. You can say something like Ryan Gosling is miscast, and that's about the harshest thing you can say about it. That's nothing.
But even then, you know what? That kind of turned me around on Ryan Gosling, because I was kind of meh about him before.
Interesting.
And that was the one I was like, you know what? He's got that thing, and it works so well in this that makes chemistry happen in an interesting way.
Well, the last, I would say, what, maybe 40 minutes of it is just amazing, especially when she does the audition part with that show-stopping song. There's always a show-stopping ballad.
Sure.
And I read recently that that was done live on set.
Wow.
And she sang that on set. She wasn't doing it to a playback.
Oh, interesting.
And it was just accompanied by the pianist who composed the song, and then they add the orchestration afterward.
Yeah,
isn't
and such haunting songs in there. They're so beautiful.
Yes.
You have
to have the great songs if you have a musical.
That's right.
For sure.
You have to have those things.
It's the sound of music rule.
That's right. You have to have the earworm, the songs that will like stick in your head that almost drive you crazy.
Exactly. I love the opening sequence on the highway, too.
That's so brilliant. Fun. Super fun. And just sets the tone that right away you are in for something very different that you probably have not seen since a Seven Brides for Seven Brothers kind of era. It's about to be different. We're talking with Pat McDonald. He is a film critic at HollywoodChicago.com and a tour guide, the chief tour guide, as a matter of fact, for the Chicago Film Tour. We are talking all about the movies that we need to see right now to get us ready for the Oscars and Golden Globes and all the things, all the award season stuff in the new year. We'll be right back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Such a fun song. That's one from La La Land. And if you have not seen it, I recommend it. It's very, very fun. It's lovely. It's very beautiful, just visually. Just the visuals alone are very pretty.
A lot of fun for everybody, too. It's really, if you want to take a big group, that's a good one to go to.
For sure. And those songs will be stuck in your head. Yeah. Absolutely. We're hanging out with Pat McDonald. He is a film critic at HollywoodChicago.com, and he's the chief tour guide at Chicago Film Tours. You definitely want to do that. It's a very fun thing. I got to get to that because it just sounds super cool. I got to do that.
Yep.
But you are closed for the season, but you do like the private tours. People can hire you up.
Private, that's right.
That's
and we're BYOB too, and have a restroom on the bus. So there you go.
So you can do the drinking,
right.
See the sights. He will tell you all about them. Don't have to worry about driving.
I did a bachelor party once. It was hilarious.
Oh, boy.
And nobody was paying attention. They wanted to go to one place in the city. So we did the whole tour to get to that one place. And then they all shut up. It was so funny.
Wow. What was the one place? Do you remember?
It was the Bean. It was the Millennium Park Bean. For some reason.
That?
It was one of his favorite movies that took place there, the Transformers movie.
Oh.
And I had the clip. So it was all good for the bachelor party.
You know, when the Transformers movie was being shot, it was fascinating to be in the studio and watch all that because Michigan Avenue was shut down and they were queuing pyrotechnics and all this stuff was going on. And, you know, we had to, God forbid you leave your building ID card because you were not getting to work that day. There was so much security. But it was so fascinating to see and then to watch it later.
Yeah.
To go, oh,
added it.
Right, because you're like, well, that's weird. These explosions are just happening down the street and boom, 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 boom. And you go back and you go, oh, that's because there's a thing blowing things up that's added later with CGI. It was very, very cool, but fun to see that.
It was huge for the tour because I could actually take them to an actual movie set.
Right.
Big deal.
And drive right down it, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, we've been talking about the films that you need to go see right now to get yourself ready to have, sound judgment and make your list for Oscars and Golden Globes and all those things.
Yes.
And there's one that I have not seen yet, but I sure want to because it looks really good. And that is Manchester by the Sea.
Yeah.
What do you think of that one?
Well, I'm sort of in the minority on this one. Not because I'm not overpraising it.
Okay.
I think it's a decent story with some incredible performances, especially, and I will say this because Casey Affleck is on the short list for Oscar buzz. He is definitely deserving of that. His performance as somebody in mourning was something totally different than you've seen before. And Michelle Williams as his ex-wife also has a couple of very poignant scenes that really reach for something that we haven't seen again in a sense of mourning with characters. Mm. Now, the story and the overall thing itself, Seth Meyer, the late night talk show host, did a little parody this year called Boston Accents. I don't know if you've seen it, but go to YouTube and type in Boston Accents, because one of the funniest parodies ever done, I swear, just because it's about people trying to do Boston accents. Mm-hmm. So again, when I'm watching this film, I was kind of taken out of it because of the Boston accents and the stereotypical, his feelings are withdrawn. Therefore, whenever he's in a bar drinking, he's going to get into a fight.
Uh-huh.
Now, if you're in a fight in a bar, you're going to get really hit. And you're probably going to go to the hospital, quite frankly, because people, you know, being inebriated are going to be overindulgent in a fight, just like they're overindulgent in everything when they're inebriated. And I just don't like that cliche anymore.
Right.
Now, that's not enough to derail the movie or anything, but I'm just saying it's not perfect to me.
Okay.
The performances are great. The story is okay. So
when I saw in the trailer and in the ads, and as it's been, you know, edited different versions of the ads, there's that clip in all of them of Michelle Williams, like, really choking back a big sob, talking to Casey Affleck.
Yes.
And as soon as I saw that, I went, oh, I bet that was one of her best moments. We just saw
it. It was. And
well, that's kind of, they shouldn't put it in the ad. We need to save it.
But you don't know the motivation behind it.
That's true.
So once you get in there and see the movie, then you'll know the motivation.
Yeah.
And can I just add, my wife went and saw that the other day.
Oh, yeah? What did she think?
She says it was a very heavy film. Said it would look beautiful.
Okay.
Acting was very good, but it's a heavy film.
Heavy's okay, as we learned from our last guest during therapy hour, that it's okay to be uncomfortable and have the full range of feelings, as she explained to us. Feel the feels.
Yep.
Right?
That's good advice for anyone, Amy.
Feel the feels. Don't bottle it up. But you know what? You mentioned you mentioned the Boston accents.
Yes.
And immediately, the film that came to mind was... No, but that's another good one. Mystic River.
Yes. Yes.
Like, pretty decent film. Like, there's some feels in that movie, right? There's some heavy feelings. And
It's the same director doing Manchester.
But that accent is so terribly done in a couple of moments, especially at the end when the couple's at the window and they're kind of having a moment and patching things up a little bit. Yeah. You're like, I don't even know if that woman is supposed to be in New England or if she almost sounds Hungarian at one point. Like, she's so botching this New England accent. Like, bless her, because I can't do it either. But like,
good chowder, Bobby.
The movie that always gets me with that is The Departed, because even though, I mean, it's mostly good, but whenever they say cop, like, I'm not a cop. C-A-W-P, cop.
Seth Meyers in Boston accent sketch has a British actor who just can't quite get it.
Yeah.
Or the person who just won't do a Boston accent. I'm going to park the car by Harvard Yard.
I very briefly I had an internship in Boston.
All right.
A long time ago, decades ago. And I had this landlady, and I thought, I am not kidding you, I thought her accent was so heavy. I thought her husband's name was spelled M-O-T-T-Y.
Marty.
It was Marty. And I just kept going, like, what an interesting name. What is that short for? And then I finally saw it written. I was like, oh, I'm an idiot. I just can't hear Boston accents.
Good chowder.
I was like, oh, it's Marty. Oh, we try.
Yes.
Okay, so what about Moonlight? What do you think of that one?
Moonlight is an expressive emotional piece. It's really about identity. And, you know, you had your psychology hour last, but there are certain socioeconomic groups that can afford therapy and look at themselves and read the self-help books. And there are other socioeconomic groups where there's no time. You have to survive.
Sure.
And Moonlight falls in that latter category. We see a African-American boy who is being raised in the harsher, lower middle class parts of Miami. We see him in his childhood. We see him in his teenage years. And then we see him in his adult years, three chapters. Same person played by different actors.
Mm-hmm.
And the last part is a one-act play where he reunites with a high school buddy that we had seen in the previous chapter. And it is so affecting. It's so affecting as far as who we are and how do we have the courage to be who we are.
Interesting.
It's really a beautiful film. Really well done. It's an education into what some of these situations are like when you grow up like that. Naomi Harris, who played M in the Bond movies, is plays the mother of the child, and she does a tremendous job interpreting that very difficult, you know, addiction state.
Sure, sure. So, well, esteemed producer Tom Hush has not yet seen La La Land, but he, like, you're on to this movie, right? That's your pick, huh?
Yeah, Moonlight. Yes. It was just right in all the right ways.
All right.
You know?
Okay. So we're gonna put Moonlight on the list. But
right,
you know what?
In all the right ways. I love that.
I just looked at the clock.
I'm gonna steal that line, sir.
There you go. Take away. I just looked at the clock and realized we got to check in upstairs with our good friend Roger Battish for news. It is 9:34 for the 9:30 news. A little bit late. Sorry about that, Roger.
That's
what's
okay.
Going on?
I love the discussions.
All right. There's no business like show business, like no business I know. Everything about it is appealing. Everything the traffic will allow. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling. When you are stealing that extra bow. 720 WGN. I did not have my microphone on, but boy, did I just sing along with Ethel Merman on that one.
Did you hold the note at the end?
Yeah. I have witnesses. Amy Goofin for Justin Kaufman on the download tonight. Thanks for being with us. Grateful to you for sharing part of your evening with us. We are with Pat McDonald. He is the chief tour guide at Chicago Film Tours, and he is a film critic at HollywoodChicago.com. He's with us tonight helping us help ourselves so that we don't get to like the night before Oscars and go, oh, I have not seen like half of these, which is what I did. I think Oscars before last, I was like, oh, wait, I have totally not seen half of these. And the Oscars are like a week away.
Well, the great thing about Chicago is that with the variety of theaters we have here, you can find them.
Yes.
And if you can't find them, they're probably on DVD or download the chip in your brain. So let's do that.
Man, I can't wait for that. That's going to be awesome. Good. Well, we've been talking about some of the obvious contenders.
Right.
Some of the ones that I think a lot of people, like La La Land and Manchester by the Sea and Moonlight and the ones,
right,
Jackie, that a lot of people are talking about. I want to talk now about Fences. That I have not seen that one either, but that looks so compelling. I saw the preview for it when I went to see La La Land, and I was like, oh, this one looks like meaty and good, and like looks like there's a lot of stuff here within the confines of a family.
Are you familiar with August Wilson, the playwright?
Yeah,
have you
definitely
seen his works or
definitely
read them? This was my first experience with one of his pieces, this film. And this, of course, is the play source, Fences, is part of his Pittsburgh cycle, which he wrote a play for every decade of the 20th century about the African-American experience in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So they actually went to Pittsburgh to film Fences, which was a nice piece of work with director Denzel Washington, who also plays the lead in the movie. And he is being touted in Oscar buzz for Best Actor, as well as Viola Davis for Best Supporting Actor. This is a stagey kind of movie because it's from a source and stage piece. And it was very interesting to me that they went on location in Pittsburgh, in the very district where it's set. That's rarely done in a film. And yet they still confined it to the house. They still confined it to the backyard, which obviously were the settings in the play.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Denzel had done this play on Broadway in 2010.
Right.
And brought Viola Davis and Stephen McKinley Henderson with him to the movie version. There's a few new faces playing other roles. But this is the actory film, the Oscar bait actory film that we're looking for every season, and it's a very emotional film. I was not in love with Denzel's character. I as written, I felt that he didn't really have any qualities that you could attach yourself to. And Washington played it a very high, kind of stagey kind of way, whereas Viola Davis kind of was a quiet, you know, emotional. Her acting skills are just remarkable.
They are next level, otherworldly. Yes, I feel like she can do absolutely no wrong as an actor. She is so talented and just brings this, I don't know what the word is for what she brings to it, but it's so emotional and it's so, I mean, she can just move her eyes 2 inches and say a whole paragraph of a whole monologue of things.
You would really like this if in that descriptive, because that's exactly what she's doing. Mm. And, you know, I think the best actors add an air of mystery to their characters that deepen the well, if you will. So Viola Davis, I think, is definitely on the short list for best supporting actress.
And that's very interesting. I think anytime you, I mean, directing yourself is always, you know, that's always kind of a controversial call, right?
Yes.
And to pull off a best actor, even best actor buzz, much less an actual nomination, right? That's you know, that's quite a thing to do.
I think the advantage was, of course, that he had done it on Broadway and done the play several, you know, then it's in your DNA.
Yeah.
So you don't really have to worry about that part of it as much as setting the composition
for
the character to play in.
Yeah, true.
I feel, and again, this is just my opinion, that Mr. Washington has... he's a working man's director, meaning he's going to point the camera and let it go rather than try to do anything that's going to give it a cinematic air.
Yeah.
So, again, I thought the film was a bit stagey, but still it's worthwhile in the sense if you want to see some really fine acting and some good interacting between those characters. So.
And then what about Hell or High Water? That's
This is one that came out mid-year. It's very unusual for a film to come out mid-year and then make it all the way past all the other stuff that comes out in the fall, because that's your Oscar season. But Hell or High Water is a truly quintessential American film set in Texas. Two brothers, one bad, one good. They're robbing banks, and they're robbing banks for a reason. And there's a guy who is on their trail, and he is played by the great Jeff Bridges, playing a Texas Ranger.
Right.
And I didn't see this until awards season, and I was just absolutely blown away by it, because we need these type of American stories. We need to. It really does help us to understand how, you know, if you want to call blue state red state, but how a red state lives. What their circumstances are, what kind of lifestyle, how the open spaces of Texas, you know, you get outside those big cities in Texas and you're in just land upon land upon land, and a lot of this having to do with the oil industry. So, all those elements are thrown into that stew with Chris Pine and Ben Foster playing the brothers, and the great Jeff Bridges, and it's just a heck of a tale.
As a Texan myself, I always say that there's two parts to know about Texas. There are the cities, which is each one has its own little vibe.
Yep.
And then there is these long stretches of land that's very beautiful, but a place all its own between those cities. It might take you a full day, 2 days, 3 days to get you between those cities you're going to. But it will, and it's like stepping into another dimension and then emerging in another. It's a very different thing.
I think you would really like this movie.
It sounds like it.
I gotta go back and see that. It's set in that hinterland.
Interesting. Yes. Yeah, I'm gonna go back and see that one. Well,
hinterland.
We are gonna talk next about Hidden Figures, which is one I'm very excited about. That is really, really interesting. We are talking with Pat McDonald. He's a film critic at HollywoodChicago.com and the chief tour guide of Chicago Film Tours. We will be back here in just a moment. Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman tonight on The Download on 720 WGN. And 20 WGN, Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman tonight on The Download. Now, esteemed producer Tom Hush played this song, this fine Irene Cara song, Fame, from the TV show Fame, about the Performing Arts High School and the movie and all that thing, because we've been talking about films. However, sidebar, I went to one of those arts high schools, and so people always go, oh, is it like Fame? Not really. I mean, kind of, but not really. It was much more... teenagers plus art equals high drama is what that means. Really.
I think the original movie explains that pretty well. I mean,
that's true.
Did you dance on the taxi cabs like they did in the movie?
I never danced on taxi cabs.
Too bad.
We cut school a lot.
Well, there you go.
And went to fast food establishments and talked about real literature.
That sounds like my high school, and I just went to public school. You know?
Right. I could have just not bothered with that whole art thing. Good times. We are hanging out with our good friend Pat McDonald. He's a film critic at HollywoodChicago.com and the chief tour guide at Chicago Film Tours. And we have been talking about all of the Oscar contenders because the buzz has started. The Golden Globes announcements have started coming out, yep. And people are starting to speculate about what's going to happen with the Oscars. So lots of people thinking about that, talking about that. And so we have been talking through some of the obvious front runners and some of the ones that may be a little controversial. But there is one that I think is going to be I'm super excited about. I hope it does very well. And that is Hidden Figures.
Yes. You know, I had there was a bit of expectation on my part before seeing this movie because it's set up to be like almost a feel good. You know, we're talking about the early days of the NASA program and their computing room. Now, in those days, computing meant you got the best minds, the best mathematicians in the country, and you put them in a single room and they did all the figuring for the program.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these people, unsung, were African-American women who were trying just to survive back then and using their brain power to do it. So, you know, the expectation, well, it's going to be another lesson movie, a feel-good movie. But this is actually just very well done. It's both inspirational and aspirational, as I said in my review, because it focuses on more of when we have a challenge or a problem, the person that solves it isn't necessarily the person you expect, but it's the person who has the best way to solve it, or the mm-hmm. best idea to solve it, or the best brain power to solve it. And that is what was stunning about it. And it was very on the African-American side of it. These were the emerging middle class African-Americans after the war, during the civil rights movement. You know, very proper. They're trying to, you know, establish themselves within society and prove to society that, you know, they belong, basically, in 1950s, 60s America. So that whole overview really was great. I mean, there were some elements to it where I said, this is no way this could happen. But, of course, for dramatic purposes, they have to condense the story.
Sure.
And, you know, the head of NASA is not going to sledgehammer a sign on a restroom. He's going to write a memo, and you'll see the right. janitor later taking it off with a screwdriver.
Sure.
So that's, I mean, those kind of elements were mm-hmm. there. But overall, a tremendously inspiring movie.
And then what about Loving?
Loving is another interesting that they're exploring these two things almost simultaneously.
Yeah.
Again, an African-American issue, but this was about the intermarrying of the races,
yeah.
which was illegal in 27 states in 1960. And there was a couple who married in Virginia where it was illegal, and they literally tossed them out of the state. The Love and their last name was Loving, which was very
kind
interesting.
Kind of perfect.
Yes. And
but here's another one where we have history to navigate.
Yes.
And liberties have to be taken
yes.
for cinematic purposes, just as with Jackie. And, you know, anytime we know how it ends because of history.
Right, right.
We know there's going to be some conflict with what we have to put up visually or for storytelling structure. And
yes.
did you see a lot of that?
Well, happen? In this case, we know they won the case.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's a step-by-step procedural on how they got there. And the movie's very deliberate. It's very, very slowly paced. And I thought the man who played the husband in the situation, Joel Edgerton, I thought he kind of struck one note with it all
okay.
the way through. A very reserved individual. So he kept that reserved nature hitting the same note in his interpretation of the character. But the woman who plays the wife in the situation, her name is Ruth Negga. She She was tremendous. She interpreted, I think, the feeling of the couple throughout the whole movie. Successful? I'm not particularly sure about that, but it certainly is notable. So
we have some enthusiastic waving going on outside the studio right now.
Dancing in front of us.
Certainly. Well, it's interesting to me how, I mean, it's always fascinating, right? Every year we look at what happened on the screen and what moment are we in culturally? Because that's always reflected. You know, we had the big zombie thing, like lots of zombie literature and lots of zombie films in a moment when we, you know, it's always like retaliation against something political or oppressive or something like that.
Yeah.
And so a lot of big conversation topics have been kind of forced to the surface recently, and so it's not surprising to me that we're seeing that reflected in our film. So it'll be very interesting to me to see what's happening this time next year and the year after that.
Yes,
because we're moving into such a very different administration that we have not seen before.
Well, it's interesting. The movies sort of reflect, you know, the atmosphere of society, but sometimes the society moves faster mm-hmm. than the movies.
Sure.
There's a great book called Five Came Back about the directors who went and volunteered for World War II to make the U.S. propaganda films. And one of the things in the book that is a constant theme is the war moves faster than what they can express cinematically.
Mm. So that's really interesting.
Very interesting.
Powerful, too. And so what about another one on your list is Arrival. What do you think about that one?
This one, you know, the Close Encounters theme has been done and done and done. But this one is really about communication because it involves 12 alien crafts that are arbitrarily placed throughout the world. So they're trying to figure out why they land in their particular places. But it turns out that the key to the whole thing is linguistics.
Mm-hmm.
So they get the top linguistics person, which is Amy Adams, played by Amy Adams. And for once, it's not, you know, we're not seeing somebody, oh, she could never be a linguistics expert. But you really do believe her.
Mm-hmm.
And you do believe that she is the key to this whole thing. So the step-by-step process in trying to understand their language is totally fascinating in this film. This is one of those underrated things. I think this is sort of under the radar, especially around award season. But I think anybody could see this and get something worthwhile out of it.
That's very interesting because I think a lot of the buzz around it is a little. I think people tend to be not people, but sometimes we think of an Oscar contender has to be a certain thing. It has to tackle a very big human way and a big human thing, and it can't be. No part of it can be unbelievable. And so I think sometimes anything even touching sci-fi or future dystopian immediately makes it implausible.
Right.
Like it's somehow less relatable, less Oscar worthy. So we don't see that as much.
And I think a lot of the fall has to come also in the fall season of films.
Yeah.
Because we have been conditioned as entertainment consumers that, well, just wait till the fall, you'll get something to see.
Yeah.
And it'll be a family drama or a highfalutin actor thing or something like that. And then in the midst of it, you know, you have the Christmas movies like Rogue One and Passengers, and as you said, sci-fi films that you know, they'll have the cachet as a Viola Davis performance, you know.
Sure, right.
So
that's
an interesting point.
Well, it's really interesting, and it seems like too they run in cycles, right? There'll be a lot of movies where I feel like a lot of people are going, "Meh, it was fine, it was fine, it was fine," and then suddenly there'll be a whole year of people going, "Holy cow, that was good!" Oh no, wait, this one was good. No, this one was better. Yeah. And I feel like this year has been like that. People are so excited about movies all of a sudden.
I truly believe this has been one of the better years of moviedom. It just seems like everything is hitting the right note, and even the ones that you think, that wasn't that great, they still have moments that you're just like, wow, you know, especially with some of these visual movies like The Jungle Book and Passengers.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we will wait and see how it all shakes out.
Yes.
When award season is behind us, we will see how right we were, if they agree with us. They haven't asked us our opinion.
Everybody always agrees with me, Amy.
Okay, that's a bold statement, and it is on the record for everyone to hear now. So there it is. You heard it right here.
They'd love to hear that in my critics room.
Pat McDonald, thanks so much for being with us tonight and talking about all the films that we should be seeing right now to get ourselves ready for award season. Find all his reviews that he talked about tonight and plenty more at HollywoodChicago.com, where he is a film critic. And be sure to go check out the Chicago Film Tour, where he is the chief tour guide.
Let me give you that number again, 312-593-4455. And my band, The Telepaths, will be at Phyllis's Musical Inn in Wicker Park on January 7th.
And he's also in a band. He does all the things. This guy wears all the hats.
A Renaissance man.
Indeed. Well, thanks for being with us tonight, Pat. It is 10 o'clock, so let's get you up to news with Roger Badish. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. The news is sponsored by Grossinger Auto Group. Here's Roger Badish. WGN, if you are watching the live stream, you just saw some Major League rocking out because I love this song and I had to dance to it and lip sync and all those good things. Hello, Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman this evening on The Download with you till 11 o'clock. At which point I will turn things over to Hannah Stanley, who is in for Patty Vasquez. But I thank you for being with us tonight. And so since you're up and caffeinated, you might as well stay up and stay up for Hannah and all that. So we're switching now. We were just talking about movies a little bit and those Oscar contenders you must not miss. And now we're going to switch a little bit. We have to take a breath because we have to take a serious note. We're joined by our good friend, Rex Hupke, who is with us by phone this evening. And welcome to the program, Rex. Always a joy to be with you.
Indeed, same here. Thank
Indeed.
You so much.
Now, we have to have a solemn note here for a moment, because just when we think we cannot possibly lose any more celebrities in 2016, we had a close one with Carrie Fisher. I know she's not out of the woods yet, but for a minute we were all like, oh, you can't have Princess Leia 2016. You cannot. And then,
yeah, no way, man.
And then right there, George Michael, 53 years old, died just the other day. And what a sad one. What a, you know, what an awful, another icon just gone so quickly and so prematurely, 53 years old. And we don't know the details entirely, the circumstances of his death yet. But, you know, 53, too young to be going, indeed.
Yeah, and on top of everything else that we more publicly known about him, I was just reading earlier today about how incredibly generous he was, a real tremendous work with charity, and really gave millions and millions to a variety of different charitable groups and causes and that sort of thing. So I he's one of the, it's funny because he sort of started out with Wham and you know, the good old 80s, and I mean, you know, look, they did great pop stuff. And,
well,
and
Careless Whisper was a ballad, and it was a good one during the couple skate ladies' choice at the roller rink that I went to.
Exactly. But you know, over time, but then the whole 80s kind of became a joke in a way as time went on, and I think he was sometimes lumped into that, but he was just a massive talent, though. I mean, and continued. I mean, he continued to do, not, you know, never maybe quite as big as he was in the 80s and maybe the early 90s there, but still, I mean, did so much stuff and just a massively talented performer and got into other things. So yeah, it's just just another huge loss. I've never found the time since 2016 started to suck so much. I haven't found the time to actually figure out when has there been a year where we have lost just these iconic figures. I mean, just one after the other, where it's been this overwhelming. I mean, maybe there probably has been. I don't know when that was, but it certainly hasn't been recently. I mean, I can't remember a year where the kind of losses in terms of you know, famous individuals who have done great things artistically or what have you have all died.
Right.
Like, well, literally everybody's, they're all dead.
And it started on January 10th of 2016 when David Bowie died. And I've been saying, even I think 2 weeks ago on this very station, I said to you, Rex Hupke, I said, I'm still not over David Bowie, and they keep going, and I have not caught up with my grief from my rock stars. I'm still grieving David Bowie. And then you got to hit me with Merle Haggard, and then you got to hit me with Prince, and you got to hit me with, like, give me a minute.
Yeah.
We all need a minute here. And then Leonard Cohen, like, no. But I cried real tears over David Bowie for sure.
Oh yeah, that was just I mean, he for so many people he was just such a amazing figure, and like one of the thing that I always said about him was that he made me feel like it was cool to be weird.
Yeah.
And you know, and I think that's what a lot of people that resonated with him, not beyond just his music. I mean, there was just something he brought to the world that was very powerful. And I think for a lot of, I mean, for a lot of LGBT people, George Michael, you know, and being very open about his sexuality, you know, that was very important and you know, really sent very positive signals to other people and to society at large. So, yeah, I don't know, man. This year can't be over soon enough for me.
I know. I was joking on the program earlier. I said, you know, I was kind of setting up the show and saying, here's what we're going to do then, and then we're going to talk to so-and-so about this and this about this. And then when I got to you, I said, and we're going to talk about, you know, George Michael and some other iconic celebrities that have left this year and bounced off this mortal coil. And I said, and then we might, like, sage the studio or something, or throw around some Florida water or holy water or whatever we got. And then I said, someone go get Betty White and wrap her up in bubble wrap.
Yeah, and that's what's so, I mean, I don't know if things are becoming more amplified over time, you know, as we are all wrapped up in social media and we're getting information constantly and through all different means and that sort of thing. But, I mean, people hate this year. I mean, people are really, and yes, I mean, there's been these high profile deaths, and the political landscape has been horribly ugly. And there's all kinds of, for many people, there's a lot of dread about next year politically. And so I think that it's like, how do we get out of this year, which has left a just god awful taste in people's mouths, while coming into next year when there's a reasonable level of dread also? I mean, there must be some cleansing ritual we can do to make sure that 2016 does not repeat itself somehow.
I mean, I said this earlier on the program, but legitimately, there is a store on Etsy, the craft exchange marketplace that it is, that is selling, that was selling, at least up until a month ago, a Christmas ornament that was a dumpster fire. It was a dumpster with little felt fire coming out of it that said 2016 dumpster fire, because that's what people keep calling it. And I know we've had some lovely things. The Cubs won the World Series. That's cool. That's a thing that happened. That was very exciting. And I was standing outside of Wrigley Field and I saw people throwing around joy like it was confetti, and it was lovely. And so there's been plenty of lovely things. But I think too, I know a lot of people that have had a lot of personally hard years. I mean, I know a lot of marriages that broke up. I know people, a lot of people that lost jobs. I know a lot of stuff where people were just like, I'm really done this year. And people that were, you know, legitimately working through some, you know, major grief and, you know, dark feelings and more than just the blues. I think there was just a lot weighing on people in 2016. And
yeah, and election,
the election and celebrity death sure didn't help matters.
No, definitely not. And the election, unfortunately, turned so many people against each other. And that doesn't, the thing that makes me sad is that, many things make me sad right now, actually, but the one thing politically that makes me sad is that that hasn't subsided at all. You know, you kind of hope after a difficult election that there is some return to center somehow. You know, there's some sort of modulation of all of the anger, fear, yelling, whatever that was happening, and I have not seen that. It seems to be just as heated as it was, and that does not bode well for the year to come, basically. And I want things to turn around. I want us to find a way to you know, get back some semblance of sanity here, and I don't know how to do it though, unfortunately.
Well, I don't don't either.
Yeah, so we're no good on that. But, you know, so, like I said, maybe
Intimation
somebody,
shows
maybe
over by.
Maybe somebody out there has some ideas.
Call
some
us
ideas,
and
like
tell us how to fix it.
Cleansing ritual.
And I hate to I hate to be a downer about it because, my default setting is like, well, you know what? That's reality, but we're going to fix it. Like, my default setting is kind of a smartass, but also very Pollyanna, kind of rolled up in one. And, I feel like I don't know. Not even the Pollyanna in me really has an answer because I do think maybe it's going to – I too have a little bit of angst about the year ahead. I think it might get a little bit worse before it gets better.
Yeah, no, I agree. Again, we need to start getting some signals from the people in charge, Donald Trump, and that sort of point to an attempt to get everybody on board as opposed to remaining divided. And the division is what's hurting us so much. I mean, I've gotten two emails in the past month relating to columns I've written from people referring to me as the enemy.
That's healing.
I think, you know what? Yeah, we can't be there. You know, we can't be, you know, all be Americans and consider each other the enemy. I mean, good Lord, what happened to just, you know, having differences of opinions?
Earlier on the program, I had a clinical psychotherapist in. We were talking about New Year's resolutions and why we're doing them completely wrong. And we called it the therapy hour. And it was quite effective. I think we all got something from that. So I feel like some of the people that write you letters perhaps should have listened to therapy hour because it was very I thought it was like there was a lot of good messages that and some of it about processing a lot of grief this year, even if it was someone we didn't personally know. There's real grief attached to if you connected with someone's work or art or whatever, their music, you know, whatever they did. And we lost a lot of people that contributed so vastly that in the middle of this time when we kind of needed our icons, in the middle of this kind of storm of political stuff where everybody kind of felt kind of mowed down by the velocity of it and how polarizing and how much of it was. I think it was a lot. And then just this evening before we went on, I found out that there's a lot of unsung ones, right? There's people that are huge celebrities that die that we all grieve, but then there's people that contributed in huge ways that we don't, that aren't necessarily famous in the, you know, pop culture way. In particular, I would like to give a shout out to Vera Rubin. She is the astronomer who verified the existence of dark matter. She just died.
Yes.
At age 88, she just died. She probably will not have like a big, lots of flowers being laid outside her home in the way that George Michael and other celebrities have had. But nonetheless, dark matter, that's a big deal. And I feel like if we're going to give a Nobel to Bob Dylan, who I love, but still, like, this woman did not get. She didn't get a Nobel, you know.
Yeah, you're right about that. And I was reading about her again just earlier, and it's amazing. And you're right. And it's hard to quantify every year who we lose. I mean, there are people, like you said, like her, people who've done truly amazing things, but just don't get into the limelight enough for a large audience to really recognize who it is and appreciate what they've done. And then there's just people, you know, I mean, there's just so many great people and you lose them and the world is worse off for it. But, you know, we don't obviously keep track of that. There's only so many people we can know and appreciate in our worlds and that sort of thing. But yeah, it does seem, I agree with you. It seems like even beyond the big names, there's just been a lot of sort of unfortunate things and deaths a lot of negativity, and I don't like that.
I kind of feel like we need a thing, like
yeah,
not like Burning Man, but like something like where we all need like little pieces of paper, and we put them in, I don't know, the world's biggest pinata, and we all beat the snot out of it, or set it on fire, or do a thing.
There you go.
I feel like we need a demarcation point. I hate for us to go into a new year feeling so anxiety ridden and gloomy. I want us to go, okay, I'm setting this aside, and I'm only gonna be positive and move forward, or whatever. I'm just gonna. This is a new era, or something. I feel like we need a thing.
Guess who?
What is that noise?
It's your payroll taxes.
Ugh.
I know. Businesses find me complicated.
I'm gonna turn that down. Esteemed producer Tom Hush, what in the world just happened? He's making faces like, ah.
We're talking about everything going haywire, and then there you go.
So and then haywireness happened. I think that's my
that was
I think that was Tom's passive-aggressive way of saying, Guth, stop talking and take a break. That's what I think he was saying.
I got you.
So I'm going to do that. So we're talking with Chicago Tribune columnist Rex Hupke and also the other half of Guth and Hupke on Politics, a podcast that you can find at WGNRadio.com. I will caution you, it is not for the faint of heart because it is not broadcast live. We might use a little bit of language in that sometimes, but there's always disclaimers on it when we do. Just letting you know that that's a thing because I wouldn't want our squeaky clean images to be shattered. That's what I'm saying.
But yes, there could be a bad word or two. You just don't know.
Mostly from me, not you. Once in a while. You said like one time, but that's it. Anyway, okay. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we're going to keep on talking with Rex Hupke, our very good friend, about celebrities that we have lost and about the year ahead and politics and all those super uplifting things. But we're also going to try to figure out what is the thing we need to do to say, okay, enough with the bad. Let's bring in the good. No matter where you stand politically or what you think about all the celebrities, whatever, like I think we all need like a thing. And we're going to figure out what that is in just a bit here on 720 WGN. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world. Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman tonight on The Download. And our good friend Rex Hupke, Chicago Tribune columnist, and the other half of Guth and Hupke on Politics, which is a podcast we do directly to WGNRadio.com. He is on the phone with us. We're hanging out. And, of course, you're playing that song there, esteemed producer Tom Hush. And I gotta call you out a little bit, Rex. You know what just happened? As soon as we went to commercial, our good friend Tom goes, hey, is it cool if I give you the young person's perspective? Not that you're old. I mean, not that you're not. I mean, yes.
I was doing my best.
It was good. I appreciate it. And indeed, you know, Hupke and I might have a minute on you. It's fine. But yes, please share the young person's perspective. I legitimately would like to hear it because I recognize that we have been griping and moaning about all of our icons that are leaving us.
No, I mean, it's the same.
Talk to me, fellow millennial.
Talk to me, fellow young man.
I also millennial, love my foot, Rex Hupke. You are back here in the Gen X line with me, and you know it.
Yeah. But the way that I see 2016 is really weird because I think, Rex, you mentioned earlier about with social media, things are kind of amplified a little bit.
And yeah.
With people my age, these are also our icons. Like for me, David Bowie was really heartbreaking because, as you said, taught everybody it's okay to be weird, okay to be different. But it's almost become fashionable to like really openly mourn these people and all of a sudden just become like the biggest David Bowie fan or the biggest Merle Haggard fan.
Okay.
Like I saw people who I never knew like listen to outlaw country and they're doing covers of Okie from Muskogee just because it's like his most popular song. And they're like, man, we'll be missed, you know, Merle Haggard. And not to say that they don't deserve to be mourned in a public way. And that's totally fine. And everybody has their way of doing it. But at some level, people are just kind of hopping on the train a little bit, maybe.
Okay. But I don't think that's exclusive to young people.
No.
Because when Kurt Cobain died, I clearly remember that people that couldn't have given a rat's foot were suddenly like, oh, man, I'm so grieving Nirvana. And I was like, please, please step aside for the true fans.
Name one song off of In Utero. Come on.
Right. Go. Name a song off of Bleach. Go.
Go. Oh, Floyd the Barber.
Okay. There we go. Slow. Yes. Good. But nonetheless, like, I don't think that's necessarily like a youth phenomenon. I think that a lot of people do that.
Yeah.
And
so much talking. No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say when David Bowie died, I cried real tears and I was sitting in my living room and I was like, this is so ridiculous. I'm sitting here crying, but I'm like, I'm just going to feel the feels. Mm-hmm. Nikki, for our guest from Therapy Hour, she would be very proud because I was not repressing the feels. I was feeling the feels and I was crying them out. Yeah. And somebody tweeted, I remember looking at Twitter and I learned he died from Twitter. I opened my phone, I saw it and I was like, oh, no way. And I went and looked at a couple of news sources to make sure, you know, people had it and it had been verified. And I thought, oh my gosh, it's real. And And I was looking at Twitter just to see what, because suddenly there was like photo galleries and videos and stuff. And someone said, oh my gosh, all you guys are grieving. You don't have the right to grieve for him unless you personally knew him. And I was like, and I sat down and I wrote a piece. It's, you can find it. It's on amygoose.com. I sat down and wrote a piece about who has the right to grieve. And I say, if you put work out into the world, especially if it is creative work that has guts and soul and sweat and blood and all that kind of personal vulnerability attached to it, if you put that out in the world, by virtue, by definition of it doing well, it's going, people are going to connect with it and people are going to feel it. And that's where you feel creative things. You're moved emotionally. They're not, it's like a math problem. Like, although I don't know, math problems can be creative
super
too.
Emotional.
Well, not emotional, but creative. Yeah. They can be artful.
Yeah.
And when you're moved by a work of art, you connect with it deeply. And so I think it's perfectly okay to grieve the person's passing who made that, because that's a part of them they put out there. And that's you connected with a part of them that they released into the world. I'm with you, though, on the bandwagonism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't. I think everybody has their own valid way of grieving, especially public figures, because there's no way you can tell how someone feels about a public figure. I mean, people say it all the time, but it's legitimately true. You know, someone might say, oh, this band saved my life. And that might be very, very emotionally true for them. And I would hate to say that that's invalid simply because there was a public death maybe of their favorite artist or something.
Well, but I think what we're really talking about here is that social media has given us, has put us in a moment where we're policing other people's feelings.
Right. I think that's the ultimate kernel of the issue.
Which
I agree with that.
Yeah. And on that note, I just looked up at one of the many screens in front of my face right now, and I saw someone making an ice cream cookie sandwich.
Ooh.
So that's a thing. That's a positive thing that happened in 2016. Holy moly, look at that.
I bet if everybody in America could get an ice cream cookie sandwich, we would really, and then turn off, like log off for like an hour and just really enjoy that. Maybe we could all come back and be a little better.
But I think
only if you add sprinkles.
Yeah, you got to roll the edges in little chocolate sprinkles or whatever, like the, what was that thing called? The Chipwich? Yeah, the Chipwich. That's the thing.
Oh, right, Chipwiches, man. Those are something.
I know. But I think this does hint at a bigger thing about policing other people's feelings, and not only why we think we have the right to do it, but why we feel like we need to. Why does it get under our skin, right, when people are feeling something that's inconvenient for us? That's, I think, the bigger question. Let us solve that on the other side of the news. So are we taking a break or are we going right to news?
We are going right to news.
We're
going to
go right to news. So let us do that right now. We're chatting with Rex Hupke. We will continue doing so here in just a moment. But now let us check in upstairs with our good friend Roger Badish. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman. With you till 11 o'clock, and we turn things over to Hannah Stanley, who's in for Patty Vasquez this evening. I know you want to stay around for that. There are people loading all kinds of musical instruments and wires and things into the studio as we speak. So whatever is about to happen on her show, it's going to be awesome, and it's going to be musical and good. So you want to stick around for that, for sure.
Can I give you a real quick update?
Please do.
I misspoke.
Yes.
Sort of.
What did you do?
Dallas has not won the game yet. There's only a minute left.
A bunch of people that bet on that game that are counting on only you because they do not have televisions.
I'm so sorry.
We're cheering.
Yeah.
So
well,
happy.
Yeah, Dallas is still beating them 42-21, and there's a minute left.
There's room for a comeback.
More.
Okay.
I believe.
I am very closely watching my fantasy football league right now. So everybody,
oh, you got it? Oh my!
It is too close that I'm being superstitious. So like everybody, chill.
All right.
I think by the time the show is done, I will know my fate. But we can't fool around with this. This is serious business.
Very serious.
This is 2016. We
cannot
fool around with 2016.
Anvils can fall from the sky this year and end it all. It's that kind of year, I'm saying.
Now you got me looking up in the sky.
See? Watch yourselves. I watch Coyote and Roadrunner.
Uh-huh.
Anvils can just fall out of the sky and dynamite can show up anywhere. I know how this goes. And by I watch, I mean I have not in decades, but nonetheless, I remember The Rub on that show. So, all right, my friends, we have been talking with our good friend Rex Hupke, Chicago Tribune columnist, and the other half of Guth and Hupke on Politics, a podcast which goes right to WGNRadio.com. We don't put it on the air. We might say darn it or something like that once in a while. So we don't put it on the air. We just go right to podcast. So we are hanging out with him this fine evening. He is joining us by phone, and we're happy to have him with us. And Rex, you still there? Uh-oh. Rex, you with us?
Here I am.
There you are. Ta-da. All right. Well, all right. So we have been talking about all the unfortunate celebrity deaths and how we kind of need like a big, healing thing to happen on New Year's Eve. Like we need to hug it out. We need
a giant, giant. You know, have you ever heard of this stuff? They're called flying wish papers. Have you ever used those before?
No, but it sounds like drugs. What is it?
Yeah, exactly. I've been, excuse me while I take a quick tug on this bong I've got next to me. No, it's...
Pardon me, I got to run out and buy some flying wish papers, if you know what I'm saying.
it's really cool. There's these, I forget where I saw these, but we had them at one point. It's a special paper, and it's like about the size of like a Post-it note or something like that, but it's really kind of thin paper, and you write your wish on it. And then you roll it up. Here's where it gets weird. You roll it up, not like a joint, but you roll it up into a tube like the size of your finger. And then you light the top of the roll of paper. You stand it upright and you light the top. And as it burns down, it suddenly shoots up into the air. And then it turns all into ashes and just kind of floats down. And, you know,
and
so
I'm
the
sorry,
idea
why
is,
do you do this?
It's a wish. So,
oh,
like
you put
a
wish on
the thing. Yeah, you write your wish on the thing and you set it up. And it's really cool. I mean, they're like, it reminds me a little bit of those, the Chinese lanterns that they send up, and, you know, those are more symbolic, but, you know, that float up into the sky and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
These are really small and it's cool. And I don't know, I just feel like everybody needs to get some flying wish papers and write what their positive thing for 2017 and send it up into the sky. Anyway, they're very cool. We used to get those and we'd, you know, like on birthdays and stuff, we'd always take those out and use them. And they're really cool. I think I don't know where you find them.
You know what?
Them myself.
I have seen this done with tea bags. You unstaple them very carefully and dump the tea out and it unrolls. It's basically like it's a rolled up paper folded in half that kind of makes the tea bag. So if you unroll it and stand it up like a cylinder and you light it, it will do that. I've seen a video of someone doing that. The poor man's flying wish paper is an empty tea bag.
Exactly. Sorry, I don't go lowbrow like that on my wish papers, but whatever we're gonna.
And you know what? Sidebar about those lanterns. I went to this this thing. It was the end of this retreat, and it was we were all on the beach, and it was a bunch of female journalists, and we had all had this, you know, a lot of thinking about the big issues and how to, you know, write about them more powerfully and how to help more voices get out in the world. And we had been putting our heads together and doing all this work. And at the end of the time together, we decided we were all going to go out and let these lanterns go over the beautiful, it was a full moon over the beach. It was so beautiful. And everybody had a partner and you and your partner had to just stand there and you have to let it fill up with hot air and then kind of get it. It'll kind of rise on its own, then you let go of it. I got to tell you, it was very beautiful in theory. We laughed so hard because we nearly burned several beach houses down.
Oops.
At no point did we get one to lift off. At one point, one kind of went out over the ocean and then immediately plummeted into the water. But it was, you know.
Was this in 2016?
No, it was 2015.
Well then,
bad omens
abound.
Right.
Yeah, that was exactly. It was a bad omen. That would be... It seems like a perfect way to celebrate 2016 would be to try to launch a beautiful lantern into the sky and have it crash and burn somebody's house down. That pretty well sums things up.
And if you want to put more foreshadowing on this, the house that was rented for this event by the group that organized it that we all participated in, we found out halfway through this retreat that the person who had rented it previously was Sarah Palin. And so if you want to put more...
Could you see Russia from the house?
It was in Alabama, so no, but...
Okay, well...
Or if you're Sarah Palin, yes.
Right. Yes. And I did get stung by a jellyfish on one of my butt cheeks.
Wow.
I was in the...
And
I was
the
in...
scar came out and said 2016.
Right. Well...
2016. We've all been stung in the butt cheek by a jellyfish.
And I was in the water with a colleague who's now a really good friend, mostly because of this, because I said, oh my God, I think I just got stung on, and it was kind of like where booty meets hip. So it wasn't, you know, but I nonetheless had to kind of like pull my bathing suit to the side and be like, oh my God, a jellyfish, help, help, help. And she, you have to like knock the little spines out of the jellyfish thing or it keeps stinging you. So she did that. And then she was like, is the pee thing true? Or what do we do? Turns out it's like, 7-Up and meat tenderizer is actually what makes, like you make a paste with 7-Up and meat tenderizer and that makes a jellyfish sting stop. But we were kind of confused for a minute because we're like out in the ocean struggling with this. And
she really had to pee.
No,
so.
She did not pee on me. But we did have the conversation. She was like, I'm willing if that's what needs to happen. What do we do right now? And I was like, I don't think I'm going to die. So let's just hang out for a minute, see what we need to do.
And you without your meat tenderizer. I mean, really. Why not?
Never. One time you need it.
The one time you need it floating out in the ocean.
It sounds like you learned the value of friendship, though.
Well,
you know, it's like
she's a very good friend now.
Yeah, these bad things happen, but think about the circumstances. You were there with a great organization of people doing important work. Sure, some bad things went down, but I think it shook out okay.
And as we were talking about during therapy hour, I turned around and quickly expressed my needs.
Yeah.
By showing her, by pulling my bathing suit aside, showing her part of my rear end and saying, I'm going to need some assistance. I think I've been stung by a jellyfish. We are getting ridiculous and punchy is what we're doing right now. We started out talking about very solemn things like losing celebrity icons and a rough political year. And we have devolved into my rear end and jellyfish is where we're at right now on the show.
I think the takeaway here is that you are recommending for everyone who wants 2017 to be a better year to rub meat tenderizer on their butt. Is that correct?
I think we just made fake news is what we did. We just need some fake news. Chicago radio host swears by this, and then we need someone else to validate that, and then it's on. It's good.
Perfect.
Lord, we have devolved in a big way. So let us get ourselves a little bit back on track here. So we do, we agree, we need some sort of thing to reset for 2017. I think Chi-Town Rising is just fine, but I don't think that's enough to do it. I think we need more than that. There is a lovely star right over my shoulder on a building across the river, but I think we need a little more than that. So I would love to hear from you. You feel free to send us a tweet. I'm at Amy Guth on Twitter. He's at Rex Hupke. You can send it to at WGM Radio, whatever, about if there's a ritual that you're going to do for the new year. I think that would be very fascinating. Or you can give us a call, 312-981-7200. I got to say, one of my favorite New Year's Eves was a long time ago. It was in the 90s, but I was hanging out with friends, and we kind of did a variation of what you're saying with those, what did you say, flying spaghetti monster wish paper, what? Whatever that was?
Yes, exactly. Flying wish papers.
The flying wish paper. We each had paper and we wrote, like, here's the things I'm releasing. Like this, you know, one person in the group was, like, trying to quit smoking. And so he wrote, cigarettes, done, bye. And then we all put the thing that we just were done with for the year. I think it was 1995 or six. We're like, goodbye 1995, this thing that plagued me, and we threw that in the fire. And then we talked for a little while, and then we said, okay, let's put something in there that we want to happen. We all kind of put a wish in there, and I don't remember if we told each other the wishes. I kind of think we did not, but we might have. And then we like lovingly placed those in the fire. We kind of threw the first thing in there with angst, like goodbye, but the second one we just kind of like lovingly placed in the fire and said, okay, it's out in the universe, it's done, it's out. And I liked that just fine. I think that was, I cannot remember my wish, so I cannot remember if it came true. But I'm okay. I'm still alive, so I'm sure it was fine.
I think that's a great idea. I love that. I think that, this earlier came up about judging other people about how they grieve or what have you. We're doing that a lot now. And, you know, both out loud and anonymously on the internet, and that we judge our fellow human so much, and we often don't look inward, I think, and sort of examine some of our own things and maybe bad habits or flaws or perhaps places where we're making errors, areas where we could improve. And so I like that. I think the idea of taking a look inward and figuring, you know, okay, what is the thing that, and maybe it's not a flaw. I mean, maybe it's a, you know, a way of things that you let yourself get too frustrated by, or, sure. you know, I mean, not necessarily just smoking or, you know, not eating right or whatever, but, you know, some more fundamental things and habits and stuff. I think that would be great. And I also think that if everybody could dial down the judgment a little bit, that would help a lot, because, and this is one area where we can, I believe, talk about all sides, all aspects of politics and ideologies and beliefs. I think everybody, myself included, does this too much. There's too much of this sort of quick reaction to something, like, I don't like the way you're grieving about someone who I don't believe you really liked that much, or whatever. I mean, you know, just these kinds of things. Or quick reactions to political things, and without thinking about anybody else, and or not taking a moment to see somebody else's view.
Yeah, well, we were talking about this a little bit with the guest right before you, Pat McDonald from he's a film critic from HollywoodChicago.com. We were talking with him about how the default intellectual setting tends to be snark, where we're talking about in terms of movies. But I said to him at the time, this applies to politics too, and anything that you, it seems like you. We can't just enjoy something. We have to find the critical thing in order to prove that we're intelligent about it, which I think is a yucky moment that we're in, because we're doing that politically. We're doing that, you know, we're doing that with film and music and things like that. We can't just say, you know what? I like that album. It's pretty good. It's not perfect, but it's good. I liked it. It's a good jam. We have to kind of be like, well, you could tell in the second track, the mix was a little this and they got the, yeah. Like, we have to be so smug about everything. And I think that's part of this moment that we're in, that we were talking about a bit earlier, of where we feel like we can police other people's feelings. We can tell people who they can and cannot grieve, and whether or not it's okay to just be joyful about something. And Rex, you and I have talked about this with the way we've gotten so polarizing and polarized in our expression and thought, that even thinking critically about a candidate, even if it's a candidate that you back, even saying, well, I'm going to vote for this person, but, you know, this issue is really interesting and controversial, and I can't say I agree with him or her in this way. Even doing something like that, pointing out one flaw, suddenly it's like a betrayal. Like you've betrayed your support of that candidate or that thing. And I think that's a fascinating moment. I think we need worldwide group therapy, and possibly like a Prozac lick in every public space to get through this.
I, for one, would just like my own private Prozac lick. I do not want a public one.
Not a shared Prozac lick, right?
I'll use the public one. Is it like a quarter? Like, you put it in a quarter and you get to,
that'd be good. Make it like a vending machine.
Yeah, and the proceeds go to, you know,
buying more Prozac for the Prozac lick.
All the people dying of hepatitis from the public Prozac licks.
Right, that. But I feel like we got to solve that. Like, I don't know the answer, but we have to solve that. This moment where we can't talk about things critically, where we're only reading headlines and the first sentence of a story, and suddenly going nuts and writing, you know, scathing comments or reviews of that thing that we just read, or, you know, we have to bring back subtlety and nuance, because that's gotten so lost. And that is reflecting politically and artistically in all of these ways that I think are so problematic right now.
Yeah, it's like we're becoming very binary. We're either all for something or we're all against it, or we're, you know, the middle is just becoming a something that's ignored. And you can even see it. I mean, look, if you send out kind of a middle of the road opinion on Twitter, for example, it'll probably be predominantly ignored. Whereas if you take a strong stand to one side or the other, then people from the other side yell and people from your side cheer. So I think that's kind of, I think some of that is what's forcing us into this, because being moderate in a sense is not doesn't, I mean, there aren't reality shows about people who are moderate. You know what I mean? Like, there's not.
Girls Gone Mild. Yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
Here's a family who's pretty reasonable and makes sensible decisions and are nice to their neighbors. I mean, you know.
Right. Here's a house full of women that support each other's ambitions.
Exactly. So, and that's just bad. And I think, I mean, one of the best ways to push back against that is to lead with that, to do it yourself. And one of the things I'm worried about, and this is a lot of people right now on the left, with regard to Donald Trump coming into taking over and setting up his administration and everything, are preaching absolute all-out resistance in the same way that the Republicans treated Barack Obama for pretty much his entire presidency. And I obviously am a very vocal a disliker of Donald Trump, but I don't like that approach. I don't think that the answer is to do the same thing that was done by the other side. I don't agree with that. I think you stand up where you have to and you resist things and stuff, but you don't just go into it with a mindset of, no, we're not going to do that ever. Bah. I mean, that's really what we've had for the past 8 years, and it's been horrific. And so to say that's bad and then to turn around and do it doesn't make sense to me. And some people will disagree with that. That's fine. But anyway, so I think that the things that we have to do are to just not give up on being able to be decent and to stake out reasonable positions and to understand other people and that sort of thing. And it's not everybody's going to do it, and so you just have to keep trying.
Well, you said on the podcast that we do, you said, you know, hey, I'm not down with the guy and his stuff, but if you know, if Trump does something that you find favorable and that you think is positive, you'll be the first to say, hey, I'm good with this. This was a positive move, and here's why I think that. Whereas I think some people are going to see that as a complete betrayal. Like, well, Hupke's joined the other side, right? Like, it's very all or nothing right now.
I think that's absolutely true. And I even right after the election, when I wrote a column saying, look, I don't, you know, this was not the outcome that I would have liked to have seen. I don't think this is necessarily good for the country, but I'm not going to sit here and say this is not my president. You know, this is, I mean, I said, look, he won. He's the president of the United States. I don't care about the, you can argue the details and the popular vote and all that sort of stuff, but that's not the way the system was set up for this election. And so too bad. This is what it is. And it happened for a lot of reasons, but yeah, so I don't, and I got a lot of bad feedback right away from that, of course. And fine, I don't care. I mean, I'm going to say what I believe and let the chips fall where they may. But I think that we're better off. I mean, our future is a mess if we just stay in this default position of absolutely no. I will not see your side. I will not consider your side. I will not look at the, you know, whatever parts, I will not try to find the parts of your side that I can agree on. That's just a horrible place to be.
Well, it deadlocks us. And it's very much like my way or the highway, which is basically what we did in kindergarten. Like, I don't get my way, I'm out. I'm take my toys and go home. You know, it was that. And that's, I find a great deal of flaw with the incoming administration as well. However, just digging my heels in is not going to solve anything. And I think that's the point. We need to, I've said on this station many times that the election night, I was standing by a woman who I did not know, but she said when things started to reveal themselves and we kind of all started to realize the way the election was going, she said, well, look, either way, no matter how this evening goes, we're going to wake up tomorrow with a roadmap. And we might like it or we might not. But either way, we're going to know what to do next. And the point is that we roll up our sleeves and we get to it and we go do that work, which I thought was a great and very level-headed thing to say in a room when a lot of people were, you know, having reactions either very positive or very negative.
Yeah, I totally agree. Right. And that's more of the outlook we have to have, I think. I think that's the healthiest and most productive thing to move forward with.
Yeah, indeed. Well, As we are sitting here running down the clock, we need to take a break and get up to news and all that. And we need to turn things over to Hannah Stanley, who's in for Patty Vasquez. And as we've been having this conversation, microphones and instruments and all these things have been running around the studio. And suddenly the studio is very full with lots of stuff. So there's going to be some great music ahead with Hannah Stanley on Patty Vasquez Show. You want to stick around for that. Rex Hupke, thank you so much for being with us. Always a joy to talk with you.
Absolutely. Same here. Thanks so much.
Certainly. Thank you very much. And everybody, head to chicagotribune.com to read all the things that he writes, because they're always very thoughtful, very funny. Not always funny, but usually funny. Sometimes you get a little serious on us, but they're good.
I like to keep people on their toes. Yeah.
You really do. You keep us guessing, Hupke. And of course, please head to WGNRadio.com and check out our podcast, Guth and Hupke on Politics. As I said, I cannot promise you that it is free of a couple of darnets and a few things worse than that. But that's why it goes right to the website and it's not on the air for young ears or sensitive ones or any of those things.
It's edgy. It's super edgy.
It's edgy.
We're edgy. Yes. I've always wanted to be edgy. Now I feel like I am. It's exciting.
Maybe that.
Yes. I think you're edgy, Rex.
Aw, look at that.
I appreciate that. Thank you, fellow millennial.
That's spectacular. All right. Well, thanks very much, Rex. We'll talk to you later.
Have a great night, guys. Thanks.
All right. You too. All right, we're going to take a little break, and then we're going to come back and get to news and all that good stuff back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN, Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman tonight on The Download. We had to play that one, just let it play for a minute, as we lost George Michael just the other day. What a bummer that one is. Another one in the long line of celebrity farewells we've been forced to do this year. The year's not over, but I hope we're done. Gosh, I hope we're done. That, of course, such a beautiful song. That's such a good one. Many, many good ones of his. And as we have been talking tonight, this band has been assembling around me, and they've been so quiet, tiptoeing in.
So polite. I'm excited to have them join us and
I'm
play.
I'm excited. Hi, Hannah Stanley.
Hi, Amy Guth. How are you?
Good. How the heck are you?
I'm delightful. I'm delightful. It is a wonderful...
Quit bragging.
It is such a bizarre night. I had a show planned, and then things started happening, and... And now we're going to focus a little bit on some mall action.
Yeah, that's happening all over the place.
Okay. Also, ironically, Aurora, Colorado was the first one. And then The second one I heard was Aurora, Illinois.
Oh.
Both took place in food courts. My speculation is that something was said on social media and they didn't clarify which state.
Oh.
And they just happened to happen at both.
Well,
both Auroras. But then it happened at other places, so who knows? I don't know. Because there's one in Aurora or Ohio. There's one in Connecticut. Yeah. They're all over now.
I was going to say, all the Auroras, no food courts for you.
No. But this is not unprecedented. 2 years ago, there were riots in five cities, including here in Chicago, one at Navy Pier. Mm-hmm. Race-related, this doesn't seem to be.
No.
So who knows? John DeCasse and Tim Banker are joining me.
Oh, lovely.
Talking about a little Steve Cochran New Year's Eve show.
That's a thing that's happening.
Soon, I hear, on New Year's Eve.
I hear, allegedly.
That is what I have been told.
Lovely.
So, happy Hanukkah.
I thank you. I did the bulbs. There's a menorah, or more specifically, more accurately, a Hanukkah here.
Okay, tell me the difference, please, because I like to learn about these.
Well, they're all menorahs.
Yes.
But all year long, see, there's four on each side of the up candle.
Yep.
There's three all the rest of the year. There's just three on each. There's a six total. So they're all menorahs. That's just the candelabra.
Oh.
But the specific one with the eight, that's a Hanukkah.
Because it is for Hanukkah.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
And we're keeping the huh in Hanukkah.
That's
what we're doing.
And in Hannah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we are. And so I noticed the bulbs were not...
appropriately lit.
Yeah, because you just screw the bulbs in. We're not playing with fire here in the studio. We're not lighting things legitimately.
No, I once made waffles in the studio as part of a thing, like a demo.
How'd that go?
There was steam involved.
It's not really ventilated in here.
And
for
I was
sound
very freaked
purposes
out that I was going to wreck things. Breaking the station is sometimes my biggest fear.
Because I feel like Tribune Tower would be a little bit, you know, flammable.
A little bit.
We got to be careful with that.
There's not as much as it used to be with the paper and such, but
also,
now we're okay.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
we're better. Yeah. But still.
Yeah, but I let the record show. It's with light bulbs, and I said the proper blessing over
did
it when I did them.
Of course you did.
Brian Noonan was looking at me like, what are the words coming out of your mouth
Exactly.
Exactly what Babs
said. Now, do I
say
amen? Is there an appropriate response?
You can.
See, these are things I need to know.
That's a perfectly good one. Or let's have latkes now. Or let's bust out the high-stakes dreidel. Whatever you need to say.
Well, when it's dry and ready.
Dreidel, I will play.
Dreidel, I will play. Hey, have you been watching the Scientology show?
Not really. Because I kind of missed the first part,
yeah, no,
so
get
I felt
in,
like I needed
get,
to...
Yeah, get into it.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's something that will likely come up tonight.
Sure.
The show. This is Leah Remini's Scientology expose show. Fascinating. And I can tell you, you don't need to watch them in order.
Okay.
Yeah. It's not like a story that builds.
Okay.
It's
just all the things. It's just documentary
adventure type
yeah
stuff. Oh. Yeah. It's okay. Really interesting. Shall I go to news? Are you done? Shall we chat more? I don't care. Roger?
I'm cutting into your time. So
I'm listening
this is
to
up
you guys.
To you. I got nowhere
I know,
to
we,
be.
We
yeah, but the later you guys go,
late.
The later
you know
I go, and the later I go, the not so quickly we can get to that great music.
This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com.